My name is Newell. There is a solution conference on sponsorship. Please help me open this meeting with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. Serenity Prayer.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And just briefly, I'm going to welcome everybody and just tell you a little bit about this conference. We started doing this about 4 years ago, and welcome to all the newcomers. We're going to be passing the baskets around for the speakers. If any of you guys have any questions for the speakers, just write their names on the top, and at the end they'll answer the questions. And we hope you guys enjoyed the food, and we hope you guys have a good time. And Melanie is going to come up and read how it works.
Okay, so Melanie, I'm an alcoholic. Okay, and this is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are conditionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. But with all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was no until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. If there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection with care and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic and the chapter to the agnostic and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we are alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
And at this time, time, Lindsay's going to come up and introduce our first speaker.
Hi, I'm Lindsay. I'm an alcoholic. Jeez, the writing. It's my honor to introduce Karen tonight. I've known her for a little while, maybe a year and a half or 2 years maybe, and I've had the privilege of spending some time with her, and she's, you know, as whatever she's going to say up here is, I've seen her that to be true in the rest of her life. You know, she's not just a good speaker, she's a really awesome gal, and a cool thing you might not know about Karen, because she's not going to talk about it, is that she actually has a story in the fourth edition. It's called The Crossing the River of Denial, and she's not going to talk about that, but, you know, I want to. And, you know, I'm really excited to hear her, and she's got, you know, a great message to carry, so without any more time for me, here's Karen.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Karen. This light is really blinding. Oh, my God. So if I squint, it's also because I can't see. Such a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Lindsay and the committee, for inviting me. And anytime I can, you know, share some experience, strength, and hope, it's an honor to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And just the service aspect is the reward in and of itself of being sober. Now, all the things I always look for when I was out there drinking, I found that and so much more in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got here, I didn't even know what I was looking for. But I found it all and then some. So that's a pretty good deal. Pretty good deal. So, let's see, where to begin? At the beginning, I usually follow the format, which is what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And sometimes I hear speakers say, I'm going to follow the format, so like what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But that's really not what the book says. And I'm a book thumper, I have to tell you that too. Because, you know, it didn't change. I didn't. So it's not about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like. It says what we were like, what happened, and what we are like now. Because, you know, the steps don't promise me that life's going to be sane. But it does promise me that if I do what you suggest in these rooms, that there's a chance that I'll be returned to sanity. And for me, that's also a good deal. So let me start with a quick story. I took a little survey before I came up to see if I should tell this story again. But it was unanimous, so so I'll tell you my pee story. Because I don't think you can have enough pee stories in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, before I moved to Florida, I've been here about 2 years. And before that, I was actually in Las Vegas for 4 years. Good AA in Las Vegas. You know, I really think that the greater the temptation, the better the recovery. And there's lots of temptation. But it's everywhere. You know, it's not just Vegas. In fact, when I came here and I was doing something at the mission over one of the holidays, and one guy told me that, you know, he went out because, you know, he'd been in Vegas. And I said, dude, excuse me, there's alcohol everywhere, and you're going to blame Las Vegas? No, you just wanted a drink. If you'd have been here or you'd been there, you would have found an excuse because you wanted a drink. So it's for me, it's never about the place. And once I start making it about the place, I have just given myself permission to drink. It's about a situation, the stress, my boyfriend, somebody went to Iraq, whatever. If I make any of those a reason to pick up a drink, I've just given myself permission. And I'll tell you, in the time it takes me to go from here to here, life as I know it is gone. And I'm just not willing to give that up yet. Not today. So, was in Vegas for 4 years, and before that, I actually got to live in San Francisco for 10 years. What a blessing. I got sober in Southern California on February 7th, 1992. So when I was living in San Francisco, just before I left, how many of you I know? Yeah, I know you. Anybody else been to San Francisco? Yeah, hi. Beautiful. And if you go across the bridge into Marin and you're coming back into the city, you come through this tunnel, and there's this incredible view of the Golden Gate Bridge and Alcatraz and the city. And I tell you, it never failed to take my breath away. It was so gorgeous. You come out of this tunnel, and it's just like, oh, my God. But on the left-hand side, there literally is no shoulder when you come out of the tunnel. You come out, and there's pretty much a guardrail. And this was a Friday afternoon. I'm coming back into the city, and cars were creeping along because traffic on Friday afternoon is always really bad. So I see the car in front of me, and I look over because everybody's looking and kind of rubbernecking and over to the left. There's a car, like, right there on the edge because, again, there's not really a shoulder with the hood up. So I see the car in front of me, get up side next to this car, and I see the driver, you know, kind of going like that, and I thought, what in the world? And I get up alongside, and I look over, and I love this story because it is such a classic example of untreated alcoholism. This is who we are without a program. So I get up alongside this guy again, hood up, engine smoking. He's standing there with his dick in his hand, giving it one of these, peeing on his engine. Bad daylight now. And I look over, and I'm this far away from the car, and, you know, my first thought, right after I thought, well, I haven't seen one of those in a while, was, I bet this is alcohol-related, right? And I could totally understand. I totally got it. You know, it's like, it's a Friday afternoon, you've had some brewskis, the car overheats, I'll piss on it. Right? I mean, it made perfect sense to me. And I know I could tell that same story at work, and people would be going like, ew, ew. And you guys get it. You're sitting there, and it's like, oh, yeah, that makes sense to me, too. That's why I need Alcoholics Anonymous so much. Because we get each other. We totally, totally get each other. And there may be other ways to get sober. I'm sure there are. Not for an alcoholic of my type. I need to come here where I can tell my truth. And you get it. You know, you totally, totally get it. So I grew up in an alcoholic home, like many of us did. But I know that my disease has nothing to do with me not having a good male role model in my father. You know, the fact that my mother left me when I was four. Ran off with another man, came back, ran off with another man when I was 16. You know, that's not what made me an alcoholic. It gave me some major pity pots to sit on while I was still out there drinking. But I know that they did the best they could. They had a disease that I happened to inherit. It's the disease of alcoholism. And it's a disease that tells me that I don't have a disease. It gives me a head that absolutely wants to kill me. And I've got to remember that. I can never, ever forget that I've got a fatal illness left untreated. It starts with peeing on engines. And it ends with either wrapping myself around a tree, killing you, or going to jail. Because those are the kind of things I did when I was out there drinking. So, if you knew, I can tell you, this is definitely the easier, softer way. And no doubt about that. And I always try and remember three things. And I put them on my little 3x5 note cards. And I put them right here in the front of my brain so that when my head starts lying to me, and it will until the day I die, I will never be sober enough that this head will not, at some point, think that a drink is not a good idea. You know, and I've heard speakers say, you know, I've been sober 104 years, and in that time I have not found it necessary to pick up a drink. And honest to God, that has not been my experience. You know, I've only been sober 18 years, And in that time, I have found it absolutely necessary on several occasions to pick up a drink or a drug. But thank God, between my sponsor, the steps, and all of you, I had options. And that was my last option. And fortunately, I was able to go through several things that kept me from picking up. That didn't mean it didn't seem like an absolutely good idea, but it did mean that I didn't have to. Not today. So the little 3x5 note cards that I've got to keep real close so that when my head tells me a lie, I know immediately where to go to think, you know, I don't think a normal drinker was arrested 5 times for alcohol and drugs. I don't think a normal drinker spent her wedding night in jail. But again, he had the problem. It was all his fault. None of this was ever my fault. No. And the third card is, I don't think a normal drinker was thrown out of the Plaza Hotel in New York City for peeing in the lobby. But Diane did it too. And I actually just thought it made for a good story. That was in my 20s. And I drank for another 17 years and didn't see a problem with this behavior. That's the amazing part to me. I look back now and it's like, how could I not see the pattern here? How could I not see that this behavior was a little abnormal? Because the depth of denial that I have, my alcoholism takes me to such a depth of denial. I truly did not know I had a problem when I got here. After all of that, I really thought you were my problem. I really believed that I was just a hard partier, not an alcoholic. Because I didn't get here on my own. You know, I mean, I'm always really impressed with people that say, yeah, I called AA. And I got here on a court card. My 5th time. And I always, you know, I don't care what brings you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If it's a court card, you know, to get you out of the doghouse at home, you know, for the cookies and the babe. I don't care what it is that gets you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Stay long enough for it to kick in. Because it will. It did for me. And I wasn't even supposed to be here. I was not an alcoholic. Fortunately, I caught the disease from all of you in these rooms. So, like I say, my entire adult life, I spent blaming other people for every time I got in trouble. It was never my fault. Never. You know, I married that husband that drank and used just a little more than I do, because then I could point to him, especially after our wedding night. I mean, if he had just kept his mouth shut, we'd have been fine. But no. He's threatening the police and he's running his mouth. And now, the fact that I was arrested for 3 felonies and 2 misdemeanors was all his fault. All his fault. So I stayed with that man for almost 7 years because he needed to be punished. I needed to be a good example for that alcoholic husband. And to be a good example, of course, and because he was drinking a little too much of my vodka, I started hiding my vodka in the bedroom in a shoebox. And I come home from work. Why should I be denied a cocktail when I come home from a stressful job? So I'd come home from work and I'd fill up that glass with ice, and halfway, I used to drink Diet Coke and vodka. Toward the end, I'd drink just about anything. Fill it up about halfway with Diet Coke and ice and walk in that bedroom and fill the other half up with vodka and go out there and set a good example for that alcoholic husband. Because he had the problem, not me. Why should I be denied? Because he had a problem. And one time, I don't know what the heck he was doing in my shoeboxes. But all of a sudden, it's Saturday afternoon, he was in there, didn't he? He comes out, and he's got an empty. And he's holding it up, and he's going, Karen, what in the world is this? Actually, he said, what the fuck is this? Then I looked at him, and I said, What? Are you accused? Because I live my life under two moral tenets. One was, deny it till the day you die. And the other was, you say anything with enough confidence and they will believe you. So I am outraged that he would suggest that this empty bottle was mine. I was angered. Now, you know, there's only two of us living in the house. So if it's not his, there's probably a pretty good chance it was mine. Deny it till the day you die. Until finally he gave up. I guess he thought some burglar broke in and left it empty. I have no idea. And I did have to make an amends for that after I got sober. And several other things, as a matter of fact. But since I knew he was my problem, if I could just get rid of him, I'd be fine. So now it's end of 1989, getting ready for a new decade. I always loved new decades. I still do. There's something very special about a fresh decade that always made me very, very excited. So I divorced that man, that alcoholic husband. I was actually in Tampa. This is actually the third time I've lived in Tampa. First time I've ever been sober. In fact, the first time I lived in Tampa, well, let me just back out, this is kind of interesting. I was living in New York City, right after the Plaza Hotel deal. And I get a call. My dad was here at the VA hospital in Tampa, Florida. And he was dying of the disease of alcoholism at the age of 60. So that's a lot of drinking to actually be dead of alcoholism. And so I got the call, and they told me that, you know, he could go at any time. If I wanted to see him, I'd better come down. So I got on a plane, packed a small bag, came down, and he didn't recognize me. He would come in and out, but it's a very, very painful death, this disease of alcoholism gives us. So he was laying in a bed with tubes in his arms and peeing in a bag over the side of the bed, and his urine was black. And his stomach's extended out to here, and basically his liver and his kidneys had shut down, and it was just a matter of time before he would go. And it's a tough, tough way to die. And Clancy tells a story about, you know, the depth of our denial in this disease. You know, if you were to go into, say, an AIDS ward at Tampa General, and that all these people with tubes in their arms and, you know, in open sores and just sick as can be, and they're dying of that disease. If you walked in and you told them, if you are willing to read a book, if you are willing to take 1 hour a day and go to a meeting, and you are willing to work with others, clean house, and take some steps, I can save your life. Those people would be tearing the tubes out of their arms, crawling across the floor to get to you and to get to this book. You can take the same book into an alcoholic ward in a hospital and say, if you read this book and you spend 1 hour a day going to a meeting, work some steps, work with others, clean house, trust God, I can save your life. You know what they say? Yeah, but you don't understand. I'm not really an alcoholic. It was the stress. It was my wife. It was, you know, all the excuses that we can come up with, all the denial in the world. And that's true alcoholism. That's really, really who we are. In fact, I had the privilege of going with a group of six other alcoholics, and we went to Russia to really carry the message at a grassroots level. And we were over there with a doctor who believed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we had translators, and we were going to places where this group had actually started meetings, you know, about 4 years earlier. And you know, and we kind of take things like central office for granted. So we went into this one little town where they had started a meeting about 4 years earlier, and they were so happy to see the people that had, you know, had been there. And they were just they didn't know what to do, because again, they don't have central office in Russia. I mean, this is like just you start a group and you hope it stays together. And they came running up to everybody going, "Oh, it's, you know, we're so glad to see you." Because they had gotten that part where it was God as we understand him, that part of the steps. And they were interpreting that as we, the group, understand God. And this is in a communist country that's atheist. So it's not like they had a really easy definition of as we understand God. So, and the group was about to tear itself apart. I mean, it was about to just disband because they couldn't come up with a common understanding of God. And so, anytime we have a problem or a dispute or we don't understand or can't agree on something, we call the district calls New York, we get help. And over there, they didn't have that. So thank God, you know, this group got here, got there when they did, and they were able to explain, no, it's we, but it's as each individual. And it was like, oh, if you've seen their faces, you know, it was amazing. Then we went into a hospital. And I'm telling you this story because of the denial of the disease and how newcomers are newcomers everywhere. So we go into this hospital, and this is not Betty Ford, let me tell you. This is the sobriety through 10 hours of work a day program. And that's what they did. They get up, they work for 10 hours, they go to sleep, get up, work, and it's detox and natural. So they come walking into this room, and it was a full room. There had to be 100 people there. And they literally just came in just gray, no light in their eyes, you know, just shuffling into this room. And again, we had translators there. We had a meeting, you know, we shared our experience, strength, and hope with these people. And it was one of the most incredible experiences. And when they'd ask questions, and they'd say things like, "Yeah, but you don't understand. Our vodka is much stronger. You don't understand. If you had my worries, you'd drink too." One man said, you know, was drinking because he didn't have a wife. Another man was drinking because he had a wife. And it was like, but like newcomers everywhere, you know, the same, "Yeah, buts. You don't understand. I'm different. I'm unique." And they would ask things like, you know, "Well, how much did you drink and how often and how strong is your vodka?" And I mean, all, and this was in a little mining town. And this was actually in Siberia, but it was summertime, so it wasn't like Dr. Zhivago. But it was this little tiny mining town way out in the middle of nowhere that, because Russia's economy had completely imploded and there was no money, the mining company was actually paying the miners in vodka. And it's a good way to keep them quiet. Yeah. And so that kind of exacerbated the problem a little bit. So after they got through their "yeah, buts," and we were telling our own stories, this one gal who was actually celebrating 16 years the week we were there, she told a story about, you know, it doesn't matter what I drank or how much I drank. What matters is I drank until I could no longer take care of my daughter. And the whole room went, ah. It still gives me chills. The identification of one alcoholic identifying with another was so strong in that room that all of a sudden little lights come on, and they're asking questions like, "Well, how did you do it?" Which is the magic word. That's the question you always want to hear from any newcomer. How did you do it? So that you can share your experience, strength, and hope. And we left, and they said, you know, "Do you have a format? How do we have a meeting?" We were there for 8 hours. I mean, it was a grueling long day. And I mean, the most amazing experience of my life. So the next day we went to another state hospital. This was just for drug addicts. They were not alcoholic in any way. Now, I am an alcoholic and an addict. And you couldn't grow up in the 70s like I did and not try just about everything. But this was a place where it was strictly, you know, methamphetamines and heroin. There was no alcoholism problem. And it started out the same way. You know, asking the questions, well, you know, I was really the only one in the group who had done drugs, but what'd you do? How much? When you go into treatment, do they give you drugs to help you get off? They were more interested in, you know, how do I get more drugs? And then the gal told the story about, you know, it doesn't matter how much I drank, what I drank, it mattered until I drank until I got so drunk I couldn't take care of my daughter. And I said, so, like, do they give you, at Betty Ford, did you go to Betty Ford? Did they give you, like, stuff to take so you didn't even face them? Because there wasn't that identification. So, I know from my experience that there is a difference between alcoholics and addicts versus an addict only. And I truly believe that if we can't identify, I mean, there's a reason we do have other programs. If we can't identify, you know, we can kill drug addicts, I think, by making them sit in an AA meeting where they cannot identify, and I can't hear the triggers. You know, I can't see when it's getting close to a relapse because that wasn't my primary drug. So if it hadn't been for that experience in Russia, I might have been one of those, you know, like, oh, it's the same 12 steps. Not really. Not really. And I think Clancy always said, which I always appreciated, you can put anybody at a table, put a needle in their arm, and put enough heroin in them, and they will become a drug addict. They will become addicted. You can do the same thing with an alcoholic and put a tube down their throat and pour whiskey into them, or somebody who's not an alcoholic, I should say. They might get alcohol poisoning. They'll throw up. But they won't necessarily become an alcoholic if they're not an alcoholic. So there is a difference. It's a physical difference. And again, it's important. The identification thing, I think, is just so darn important. Because our denial is different. Our triggers are different. And I think we need to, like I say, I did everything. And I tried NA. I went to NA a couple times. But for me, everything I needed for all of my symptoms, I could find in Alcoholics Anonymous. And have to this day. And this is everything this is my church. This is my social life. This is where I come for fun, for friends, and for free. And I get it all right here. So after, I digress. I don't know where that goes. It was because I was telling you about the three times I lived in Florida. So came down, my dad, never went back to New York City. You know, got into a relationship that was just drug, sex, and rock and roll, and the worst relationship in my life. And I've had some pretty bad ones, let me tell you. But this guy, oh my goodness. And that's when I got my first DUI. My first arrest was actually coming back from an Allman Brothers concert in New Jersey on my way back to New York City. And we got busted for some pot and stuff like that. And it's like, in the 70s, going to an Allman Brothers concert, hello? I don't think you can get in without a joint. I mean, so, and it was a misdemeanor. Sometimes I forget to even count that one because it was a misdemeanor, $150 fine. It has since come back to haunt me 37 years later. When you try and get professional licenses and things, that's still on my record. So, be careful, and also watch out for Facebook because I think some of that can come back too. So got my first arrest in New Jersey. Second was my first DUI. And I was actually living in Brandon at the time. And was driving home in a blackout. And the cop pulled me over. And I said, officer, I actually came to, handing him my driver's license. I'd already been talking to him, okay? God only knows what I'd been saying. Blah, 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 blah. Oh, my God, I don't even think about that. Handing him my license, and I remember saying, officer, I'm just trying to get home. And he goes, well, where do you live? I said, Brandon. He goes, ma'am, you're on your way to St. Petersburg. I said, shit. Busted. Damn it. So I went to jail, and it scared me. It really did. I mean, I was driving in a blackout. Good God. And that's, you know, I could have hurt you. I could have hurt me. I could have, God only knows what I could have done. So I, scared me bad. I had to go to these alcohol classes, but they were the kind that shows you the blood on the highway. You know, it wasn't about identification or any of the spiritual means that we need, I think, to get sober and stay sober. And darn if 3 months later I don't get popped again. And I swore this would never happen. But I didn't understand the problem. Until I understand the problem, I cannot find the solution. I did not know I was an alcoholic. I did not know there was absolutely no amount of alcohol I can safely put into this body. None. Didn't know that. So, I go out, have a few drinks. Before I know it, I'm being popped again. 3 months later. And I knew that was going to be serious. So I was actually able to take a transfer with my company to Pittsburgh. And back then, all the computers weren't hooked up. So you could just walk into the DMV and say, somebody stole my license. I lost my purse. Whatever. Sign a little form. They give you a brand new license. It was just magic. So, stayed in Pittsburgh for a year. Do you know it's cold up there? And after having lived here, it was like, there are options. I don't have to live. Then they wanted me to go to Chicago for it. And I said, no. So I was either going to go back to California, which I had been after college, to Arizona. That's where my mother lived. I really didn't want to live that close to her. Or back to Tampa. So I decided to come back to Tampa. And had a brand new shiny license. And it was, life was good. And that's when I met. He may not have been Mr. Right, but he was Mr. Right now. And then we got married, and we ended up spending our wedding night in jail and all that craziness, and then went out to Southern California, 1990. Left his sorry ass here in Florida. Out in Southern California, new job, it was like, and it was a new decade. It was so exciting. Little did I know that I took me with me. And I was an alcoholic. I had a disease that told me I was fine. And now I didn't have to set an example for that alcoholic husband. And that's when my drinking really took off. And I ran into a bunch of people who, imagine, drank just like I did. And we partied. We did stuff. Which is another way I stayed in my disease. I mean, I own my own home. I used ice cubes. I had all my own teeth. How could I be an alcoholic? And we did stuff. Right? We'd go deep sea fishing down in Mexico for 3 days. Stay drunk the whole time. But we were doing stuff. Chili cook-offs. We were really big on chili cook-offs. And we had a chili booth, which was better than a lot of places people live in Mexico. And we stayed drunk for 3 days. And we'd go to, you know, Laughlin, we'd go to, you know, all over California and do chili cook-offs. How could I have a problem? We're doing stuff. Then we're playing softball. And I started drinking about 10 in the morning. Playing softball, we're doing stuff. Then we went to the bar. And I was going home about 7 o'clock that night. And started to get a little dark. I could see fine. And this old woman pulled out in front of me. She should not have been driving. It was all her fault. Well, she should not have even been driving, the old broad. So I had to just nick her a little bit on the fender. Let her know. She was in the wrong. By that time, you know, the heights of my arrogance and the depths of my denial were so huge. I actually waited for the police so I could make sure. Why should my insurance rates go up? When she was wrong, she was the problem. Well, once again, cops get there. It didn't take them long to see who the problem was. Plus, brunettes never catch a break with cops. Everybody knows that. It's a fact. Blondes, they get away. Not brunettes. So here I am, fifth time. Hands behind my back. I am taken to jail. Still didn't know what the problem was. I just had bad luck with cops. And went to court. And thank God, you know, this judge could see the problem. And I was sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had to come to these stupid meetings to get my card signed. I didn't know I could sign it myself. So I'd come to the meetings and, you know, pretend like I was listening. I'd be reading the walls while you guys are talking. And I was so angry because you were happy. You were having a good time. You had friends. Your lives were getting better. Mine wasn't, because I was doing all the things an untreated alcoholic does. And I'm driving while drinking. I'm driving on a suspended driver's license while drinking. You know, all the insane behaviors that we participate in when we're untreated in our disease. And I was so mad I'd have to sit here and you'd be saying all these stupid things like, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I'd say, then you don't drink like I do. It's 4 or 5 before I catch a buzz. Well, you'd be talking about how grateful you are to be an alcoholic. And I'd think, oh, this is such a cult. What is wrong with you? And you were just so happy, laughing about things that were just like, oh, hon, I can't believe you said that out loud in public. And you'd all laugh. And you were happy, and you were grateful to be an alcoholic. And I'd sit there thinking, I wonder how happy you'd be if I stuck a pin in your eye. I was so mad. I didn't belong there. I shouldn't have been there. And every time you came to that part in the big book reading about how, and if you want what we have, and my ears would just close. Because I didn't. You had the disease of alcoholism like my dad. The last thing I wanted was what you had. I had no idea that this was the answer, not the problem. So I had to sit in these stupid meetings, get my card signed, and I saw magic that I couldn't deny. I could not ignore the things I saw in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mean, people that would come in, crawl in, so broken and so sick. And pretty soon, you know, they'd have a few friends. And then they'd get the roses back in their cheeks and they'd start to feel better. And then they'd get a little job. And then there'd be a God in their life. And their lives started changing. And mine wasn't. So I knew I wanted what you had, but I was terrified. I had no idea what a sober woman acted like, talked like, felt like. And even though I hated this woman I'd become, I hated her. This drunken woman who could not control her behavior. She was familiar. I knew what she looked like. I knew what she sounded like. I knew what she felt like in the morning. And it was familiar. The thought of living life without taking the edge off at all, I couldn't even imagine it. I just couldn't even imagine it. So I always say, I'm always amazed at people that can get sober before the holidays. You know, my sobriety day is December 24th or, you know, January 1st. What? I couldn't get sober until after Super Bowl. I knew I wanted to try this, but it was like, one more kick-ass party. Then we'll try this thing. So I went to that party on Super Bowl Sunday, promising myself I was not going to get drunk. Promised myself. Because I truly believed, since I still didn't know what the real problem was, I couldn't find the solution. And I believed that being sober meant being able to drink without getting drunk. Being able to drink like a lady. I really didn't think you mean don't drink at all. So I went to this Super Bowl party, swore I wasn't going to get drunk. But once I put alcohol in my body, I have no idea what I'm going to do. So, true to form, didn't make it home that night, slept on somebody's couch. I was getting that unattractive toward the end. Slept on the couch. And went to work that Monday, sick as a dog. Then that Tuesday, we had to go up. Now I'm in Southern California at the time. I was in Orange County. That Tuesday, we actually had a work event up in L.A. We're going to a hockey game, to a Kings hockey game. So we all got together, went up there, and since it's a work event, I can't really drink the way I like to drink. And I remember I had 2 big cups of beer, and these were hockey cups of beer, right? And it was like water. 2 big cups, and I didn't even catch a buzz. Nothing. Didn't even feel it. And something in my head said, then why bother? poof, where'd that come from? Because my head says, have two more. But the minute my head said, why bother? It struck me, because in Southern California, we'd read everything. We read that part of chapter 5. We read the part of chapter 3, more about alcoholism, or there is a solution. And it talked about the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is to control and enjoy his drinking. And I knew then, on Super Bowl Sunday, when I enjoyed it, I could not control it. And at the hockey game, when I controlled it, I couldn't enjoy it. And I knew then, to the tips of my toes, at a cellular level, that I was an alcoholic. That I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the next, the same place I'd been going for the previous 5 months. I was on a 6-month court card. Thank God I got it in 5 months. Because I think if I'd gotten off that court card, I didn't want to think where I'd be today. I didn't want to think about the kind of men I'd be bringing home today, okay? Oh, they'd bite off your arm to get out in the morning. Oh, it'd be bad. It would be so bad. So I went to that meeting that Wednesday night, and when I get tired of listening to you guys in the meetings, you know, I'd read the walls and, you know, all the mottos and live and let live, think, and all the steps and those little blinds that don't come down. And I probably read that first step 100 times. And this time, it was like a lightning bolt, because I knew it was true. I was completely powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable, and I was an alcoholic. Just like my dad, but also just like you. And the women just surrounded me. And, you know, when I first got sober, the message was, you know, the metal patch on the ass, but the woman will save your ass. And that is true. That is so true. And in fact, with newcomers, you know, and I know you guys are trying to help. Seriously. But when you go up to a newcomer woman after a meeting, and the woman can't get to her, you're really hampering a recovery process there. Because there's, I don't care how much you might be trying to help, there's nothing you can tell her about how to be a sober woman. We can do that. So it kind of helps if we can get to her first. So, a bolt of lightning hit me in that meeting, because for the first time when I read that first step on the wall, I asked God for help in a way I never had before, ever. And it was just that. God, help me. Without any conditions, without any clauses, without any and ifs, yeah, buts. If you do this for me, I promise I'll do that. If you let me out of this one, none of that. It was just a total surrender of God, help me. And I went home from that meeting that night and had that half-gallon jug of vodka in the cupboard, and for the first time in more nights than I can tell you, I did not have to open that cupboard. And how many other nights I had come home promising myself that I was not going to open that cupboard that night, but somehow I would find myself in front of the refrigerator, half full of vodka and ice, telling myself tomorrow, you know, I'll do it tomorrow. And tomorrow never came. And this night, I did not have to go to that cupboard. So when I took the first step in that chair, when I came home, the second step was in my face. Absolutely in my face. God was returning me to sanity. Doing for me what I could not do for myself on so many nights when I promised myself that I wouldn't. So it was amazing. In my first 30 days, totally into AA. The women surrounding me, going to meetings every day, twice or three times on Saturday, because I didn't want to go back to where I was. And I knew you guys would keep me, and for the first time, somebody wanted me to be there. It's been a long time since that had happened. So I stayed real close to Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't go back to visit my family in Arizona. I just needed to stay close to you. So I didn't go home for that first set of holidays. Because again, my family's crazy. And I needed to be close to you. So that's what I did. And I took that 30-day chip. Amazing. That was like a precious piece of metal. And in California, Southern California, we give chips at every meeting. It was a big deal. And got that 30-day piece of magic metal. And a gal drove me to a conference, an AA conference up in Anaheim. I was so blown away. There were 2,000 sober alcoholics laughing and getting and staying at the hotel. And it was such an event. And I couldn't believe the energy, the joy. 24-hour meetings. I mean, it was like I'd never seen anything like it. And I wanted what you had more than I wanted to breathe. I just wanted to be able to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went home from that meeting, and it was in the afternoon. I got on my knees in my bedroom, and I begged God. I said, God, I don't care what it takes for me to stay sober. Take the house, take the car, take the job, whatever it takes. Just help me to stay sober one day at a time. And that was the day I truly learned. Be very careful what you pray for. Oh, I tell you, it got ugly. Lost the career at 5 months. Also got into an early relationship, which I don't really recommend, but I never had sober sex. So he had 4 years, and he was a god. And so I got into a relationship at 43 days. Not a good idea, but... And the day I lost my job, he breaks up with me. You couldn't have timed this a little better, dude. I mean, hello. In the first 6 months, my house was robbed. Had a cancer scare. The heartbreak. Lost the career. And it's like, okay, what else? But the magic of all of that, God was truly showing me that there was nothing that I had to drink over. There was nothing that would have fixed or made better one thing in my life. Wouldn't have brought the job back. Wouldn't have brought him back. He was in AA. House still would have been robbed. I mean, nothing would have been better, but I would have lost you and I would have lost hope. And just that incredible lesson of someone in the kind of denial I came in with to show that there was no reason that could make me pick up a drink. And to this day, the only reason I will ever drink is because I want to. You can't make me. He can't make me. The job can't. Nothing can make me. I can make it an excuse, but nothing can make me pick up a drink unless I want to. And that is certainly not my story today. So first 6 months were incredible. I was out of work for a year. Got very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. Worked at central office, volunteered, did stuff with my sponsor, picked up her cleaning, you know, for $8 an hour. I left a job of $165,000 a year, which back in the 80s wasn't bad money. And now I'm working for my sponsor for $8 an hour. And thrilled to do it. Absolutely thrilled to do it. Then I got a little job. And that little job got a little bigger. And I suited up and I showed up. And I went to AA every single day. And I knew that I had to keep this first. This had to be the most important thing in my life. In fact, I was just talking to a sponsor today, and some therapist was saying that it's harder for a woman to stay sober than it is a man. I'm going, bullshit. That's crazy. But then she pointed out that you're such caretakers, you know. We'll miss a meeting because we've got to take care of little Johnny. Or we'll miss meetings because he wants his home to cook. I mean, all these things that we will not put our sobriety first because we have all these things to do and all these people to take care of. And that kind of made sense, you know. So I think for us, we've got to be even more diligent and rigorous about making sure our priorities, because without sobriety, without Alcoholics Anonymous, we're going to lose all that anyway. We're going to lose the man, we're going to lose the house, we're going to lose the kids. So we've got to put this first. In fact, when I first got sober, there was an old-timer who used to say, as long as I put Alcoholics Anonymous first, everything else in my life. Wait a minute. That's not how that went. Anyway, something like, as long as I keep AA first, oh, everything else will be first class. And that truly has been my experience. So, the job got better. I got to move up to San Francisco. Miracles occurring in my life. I stayed very, very, very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And since Lindsay mentioned, I do have a story in the big book. It's on page 62. It's where it talks about how we think our problems of our own making and itself will run riot. That is such my story. Always will be. But then, I guess I was about maybe, I don't know, 6 or 8 years sober. I don't know if any of you remember this, but they were going around to meetings, and they were actually had these papers, and they were saying, you know, they're going to come out with a fourth edition of the Big Book, and if you want to submit your story. Do you remember? And a bunch of us, you know, one of my friends was saying, oh, come on, let's do it. You know, I'm going, no. So, yeah, come on, it's a once in a lifetime, you know. It's so we all submitted our stories, and he wrote a little letter back, and, you know, mine said, thank you for your submission. We'll be getting back to you. And I didn't realize, I thought we got the same letter, and theirs actually said, thank you for your submission. We will be getting back to you. And then, like, 2 years passed, and didn't hear anything. And then one day I'm at work, and I get a call, and it was central office in San Francisco. And they knew where I was and how to get in touch with me because I was very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a secretary. I was a treasurer. In California, they have 12-step lists where you put your name on a list when people call central office, which that's something else we got to do. We need to get a 24-hour hotline going here. The hand of AA should always be available. And so we're going to work on that. Okay. So I get this call, and it was central office in San Francisco. And they say, New York central office wants you to call them. Oh, my God, what have I done? My first thought is, shit, I'm in trouble. What have I done? They found out I'm not a good enough AA. They're going to ask me to leave the club. I had no idea what it was, but it scared me to death. I thought, oh, my God. And I still have this fear that when I die, the person in front of me in line will be Mother Teresa. It's like, damn, I didn't do enough. I knew I should have done more. So they kind of let the cat out of the bag and told me that they were calling me about the big book. So I called New York, and first they read a couple of things out of the book, out of my story, to make sure it was me. And thank God I didn't drink. How embarrassing would that have been? So it was me, and I asked, I said, you know, how did you pick them? First I said, how many submissions? I thought there would be tens of thousands all over the world. I mean, I thought, my God, I thought everybody would be doing this. There were only 2,500. Which I thought that was kind of low. And of those, they selected 25. And the ones they took out of the book, you know, they put them in a separate book. So they're still available. And they're wonderful. So I said, how did you select them? And they said, well, we were looking for three things. One, you couldn't stop drinking. Two, something happened. And three, your life changed. So that's my story. And like I was telling Lindsay, you know, I didn't do anything you didn't do. I got drunk and I got sober. The only difference is I wrote it down. But we all have a story in the big book. In fact, one of my sponsors, my first sponsor in Las Vegas, when I told her, I said, I have a story in the big book. And she goes, we all do, honey. I said, no, really. She goes, yeah, I know. We all do. No, you don't understand. So, I just burst into tears immediately. It was, to this day, you know, and continues to be one of the most humbling things that you could possibly imagine. Talk about an ultimate 12 step. You know, the gift that keeps on giving. In fact, Blair just told me something tonight. He takes a meeting into the jail every Saturday, once a month, whatever. And a convict came up to him, and they were reading the big book, and they were going to go through the first three chapters, and the guy had been reading the stories, and he actually said that, you know, this story is the one that really jumps out at me, and this is the story that touched me, and it was the story called Crossing the River of Denial. And I think it's kind of cool that we know that we're real people, you know, that this isn't just 50-year-old or 75-year-old stuff, and it's real, and it's just a 12-step. It's just another 12-step. So one last story, and then I'll wind up. Before I was leaving San Francisco, Gal asked me after my Saturday morning meeting if she could have coffee. We could have coffee. I said, of course. So we sat down, and she told me this story. Her name is Kimberly. She was 28 years old, and she said when she was, you know, first come to San Francisco, she knew she had a problem with drinking, but, you know, she really didn't care. She's 28, she's cute, she's an attorney, she's an alcoholic, who cares? At 28, if you're cute, you're an attorney, no big deal. But it was starting to create problems in her life. So she actually went to this women's meeting down in the Marina District. Still there. Good meeting. And she hated it. And all these women were just too damn perky, having too much fun and laughing, and she just didn't fit in and didn't like any of them. But she did pick up a big book, and she went home, and she started reading the first 164 pages. Hated that, too. Didn't relate to any of it. Didn't make any sense. So she decided, what the hell, I'll just open it. And she happened to open it to a story. It was called Crossing the River of Denial. And she read the story and related, you know, and knew then that she truly was an alcoholic and that she wanted to try this thing. So she started going to meetings, and she got close with the women and found a sponsor, and her life started to get better, and the miracle was happening. And then she got a year. You know how we get that year, and we get this delusion of wellness. We think, oh, I can do this on my own. I'm fine. I went a year. So she was going to a meeting on Tuesday night, then on Union and Steiner. And she decided, she'd already made up her mind, if there was a parking place, which there's never a parking place at Union and Steiner, you know, if there was a parking place, she'd go to this meeting. It was a young person's meeting. If there wasn't, she was going to go to the bar. So she pulls up. Damn, but there's not a parking place right in front. Unbelievable. And again, in San Francisco, you've got to remember, you do make life-altering decisions based on parking places. You have to, because they're just impossible to find. So the fact that there was a parking place right in front. So she goes into this meeting. It was a young people's meeting. And it's the speaker meeting. The speaker starts talking. It was a woman. And she starts hearing the story from Crossing the River of Denial right from this woman's mouth. And I was the speaker that night. I'd never been to that meeting before. And I don't think I went to it even after. So she was just making a decision about drinking. And I'm the speaker at the meeting. What are the odds? You can't make that stuff up. These are the kind of God dots that get connected in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the power, not of the person, but of the book, of the message, and the higher power that we find in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she knew then that she was in the right place. She's now in Atlanta, doing well. She's about 8 years sober now. We still stay in touch. And that's the power that we give each other here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wouldn't trade that for anything. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Karen. At this time, we're going to be taking a short 10-minute break before our next speaker. And during this break, if you guys have any questions that you want that you have for Karen, there's baskets on, I think, every, or maybe not on every table, but they'll be going around if you want to write down questions with the speaker's name on top. And we'll be coming back at about 5 till.
Hi everybody, my name is Danny and I am alcoholic. Twelve traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, accepting matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Lease problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. Ten, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. NCAA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
And now Terry's going to come up and introduce our second speaker.
My name's Terry. I'm an alcoholic. I'll tell you what, I was really blessed back in January. A close friend of mine told me about this guy that's coming out to speak for us tonight. And he was speaking out in St. Pete, and I had no idea what I was walking into. I went to a meeting I hadn't been to before. I didn't know anybody there, and I was kind of standing by myself doing what we do, not willing to go and talk to somebody I didn't know. And, he grabbed me. He shook my hand, introduced himself to me, and, I kind of felt a little bit better from there. And then he took the podium, and I heard Lloyd talking to somebody about my experience at this conference last year, and it changed my life. The speaker last year told me about Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that I haven't heard it done yet. And that night in January, Dave did the same thing again. And, you know, when the committee, and I just want to thank the committee, we've done a great job, you know, to put this together, and thank everybody for coming out tonight. But when the committee okayed Dave, and I called him and talked to him, you know, I've talked to him a few times since. Just the enthusiasm is something that I try to do, and I can't come close to it, but, you know, we picked Dave up today. We had a great time with him, you know, told jokes, laughed, everything like that. And, you know, he asked me to do one thing with this conference, and that's fill the room up for him to carry the message, and that tells me something about a primary purpose being worked. And, you know, I'm going to let Dave come up and do his thing from here.
Hi everybody, I'm Dave Perry, I'm an alcoholic. Wow, thank you guys so much for having me. I want to thank your committee. I want to thank you guys for taking the time to think of me. Terry, Drew, you guys are wonderful. I had a great time. Thanks for picking me up. And I consider it an honor and privilege to be able to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. When asked to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous, I was taught when asked to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous, we try to make ourselves available. I was lucky enough and I was blessed enough when I was 8 months sober this time around to have a man put in my life who told me about these principles, who told me how to live by these principles, and told me what Alcoholics Anonymous was really all about. He cut right to the chase. We're nothing but the message delivery business. This is nothing but the making it available business. That's all we're doing here. We're just showing up. Just showing up carrying this message. Not my message. This is not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous according to Dave Perry. This is the message of Alcoholics Anonymous according to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 100 men and women who wrote it and the millions who have followed it since. You know, the 11th step tells us, you know, just praying for the knowledge of His will and the power to carry that out. I didn't know what that meant for a long time. I asked my sponsor, geez, what does that mean? He goes, well, it goes like this, Dave. God, I'd like to know what you want me to do today. That's simple. So this morning I got on my knees and said, God, what do you want me to do today? I'd like to know. Please tell me. Show me in obvious ways. He goes, I want you to jump on that plane, get to Logan, fly out of Boston, head down to Tampa, and I want you to meet those guys tonight. I want you to carry my message. I said, cool. What do you want me to tell them when I get there? He said, I'll tell you when you get there. Just show up, you know. Just get there. Just get there. That's all you need to do. My sobriety date, you guys, is November 15, 2001. I'm coming up on 9 years in another month or so. And November 15, 2001, when I got sober. This time around, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say I came back because I've been here before. This is not my first time. Prior to November 15, 2001, prior to that, I'll be in and out of alcoholics, in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. For 12 years. I was a chronic relapser. I couldn't understand what you people were doing. More often than not, when I was here, I didn't want what you people had. More often than not, when I was here, I didn't want to be here. More often than not, I'm just sitting in your seats. And during every spell of sobriety I might have put together during those 12 years, during every spell, whether it was a week, whether it was a month, whether it was a year, or 1.3 years, every stretch of sobriety I ever had during those 12 years, in and out, in and out, in and out, I can report to you here tonight. And I didn't fly all the way in from Boston to lie to you. I'm here to tell you the truth. I can report to you every one of those stretches of sobriety were marked by a few commonalities, and the first and foremost being, for the most part, I was miserable. I know how to stay sober and be miserable doing it. I got that down. I do that really well. You know what I mean? Untreated sobriety. Untreated alcoholism. I'm under the mistaken delusion that just because I'm not drinking today, I'm in recovery. I'm under the mistaken delusion that just because I'm drinking today, everything's going to be great. I'm under the mistaken delusion that I'm going to be happy, joyous, and free. You see, I was under the mistaken delusion that I was supposed to be coming here, and you guys were going to teach me how to patch up my old life, and I was going to live sober in it. That's not what I'm here to do this time around, you guys. On November 15, 2001, I closed that chapter, ended. I started chapter 2. We're not here to patch up our old lives and live sober in you guys. We get brand new ones here. The book talks about being reborn. The book talks about our lives becoming recreated. The book talks about a new freedom and a new happiness, not the old one back again, polished all up and given to us shiny and shiny. It's brand new. And I didn't know that back then. 12 years, in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. But here I stand tonight, and I'm here to report, and like I say, I'm here to tell you the truth. Here I stand tonight, almost 9 years sober, happy and sober, happy, joyous, and free and sober. Happy and sober, you guys, in the same sentence. Go figure. Before, it's like, make up your mind, one or the other, you're happy or sober. How you're putting that together, I'll never know, you know what I mean? I'm not getting that, thanks very much. But here I am tonight, I'm happy and sober. In the same sentence, you know? I'm free. I'm free. The obsession's been removed tonight, you guys. I'm not here fighting a fight. I'm not here tonight hanging in. I'm not here tonight with a monkey on my back, you guys. I'm not shooting for midnight. I've been set free. It's been that way for almost 8.5, almost 9 years running. Why is that? What's the difference? Why are these 9 like this when those 12 were like that? What's the difference? It comes down to one thing. Every time I speak, it comes down to one thing. I summarize it in one word. You know what that word is, you guys? Sponsorship. Sponsorship. This time around, God put a man in my life who became my sponsor. God inspired, God directed, God sent. God inspired, God sent it to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. A guy who showed me, he didn't tell me, he showed me what this thing was all about. A guy who told me the truth, told me what his job would be from the very start. He says, my job, Dave, is to take your hand and ask you to hold it. Ask you to trust me. Trust me, David. I'm going to walk you down a path. It's a pathway to power. I'm going to walk you down that path. I'm going to put your hand in the hand of a power greater than yourself, and then I'm going to step aside, and then I'm going to go home. I ain't going to stick around. I'm not going to stand by you. I'm not going to play God, and I'm not going to go home and stand in front of the mirror and admire what a wonderful job I do with Dave Perry. I'm going to go and get me a new guy right away. And you know what else I'm going to do, Dave? I'm going to teach you how to do the same thing. The greatest gift this guy gave you guys was he taught me how to carry this message. The greatest thing that this guy did for me, he showed me how to pass this simple message on to God's other kids. You know, he told me the truth. He didn't care what I thought. He didn't care what I felt. And he told me that. He didn't care about my feelings. He didn't care. It wasn't his job to care. He said, I'm going to show you what to do. And if you want what I got, just I'll show you how to get it. He says, I'd rather step on your toes before I stand on your grave. I'm going to tell you the truth. You know the truth of the matter of this, he said. You've been lying all your life and people have been lying back. It's about time you heard the truth. And he's right. I have. I've been lying all my life, you know. He goes, let me tell you, Dave, this is a program for the people who want it. Needing what we have here means absolutely nothing. God knows I needed what you had for 12 years in and out. I needed what you people had. I'm coming here on every basis. I'm looking around. I know you're not lying. There's something going on here. You guys are coming here on every basis and you're not drinking on purpose. I don't get that, you know. Something must be going on. And I don't know what it is. But he told me, David, until you want this, you can't say the right thing to someone who's not ready to hear our message, you guys. You couldn't say it. 12 years I wasn't ready to hear your message. I didn't want what you had. I heard a guy in Boston say it one night. My God, he couldn't have made it any simpler. He said, hey, if you don't want what we got, guys, don't worry. You ain't going to get it. Relax, kick back, have some coffee. We'll hang later on. But if you're looking for recovery, don't worry about that. It ain't going to happen. I thought it was. For 12 years, I thought just because I sat next to the guy sitting there shiny and new and smiling and happy and free and all that stuff, I'm going to get what he's got just by sitting beside him. He's going to rub off on me or something, you know what I mean? Look, I didn't get drunk watching the guy next to me drink. What makes me think I'm going to find my recovery watching the guy next to me take action? You know, my sponsor said, how long are you going to come to a 12-step program, David, ignore the 12 steps? In my case, 12 years, but that doesn't make any sense, you know what I mean? That's what it came down to. This guy told me the truth. He told me the truth. Sponsorship. I finally became one that someone else showed me what to do. The arrogance and the ignorance I walked through that door with, thinking I know more about this deal than all you people combined. That arrogance almost killed me. You know? You know what else he told me? It was right in this book. Right in this book. You know what else he told me? He told me, David, we suffer from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Only a spiritual experience will conquer this illness. Oh, my God. Only, what kind of illness is this anyway? I'm just a guy who likes to party. I couldn't even connect this illness dot together, you know what I mean? I didn't see this as an illness. I'm just a guy who likes to drink every night, you know? I'm just a guy who likes to catch little buzz after work. I work hard, I play hard. I work hard, I play hard, you know? Try to destroy everything good in my life. I don't see this as an illness. I'm not getting that piece of it all, you know what I mean? It's an illness. You know, I like the kind of illness where, you know, you just give me a couple of pills and I'm feeling better, you know. If there was a spirituality pill out there, guys, I take it. I take two. I know me. You know what I mean? I'd double the script. Sure I would. I know me. I just know me. You know? I wish, why can't this be the kind of illness where you just put me in the hospital for free, cut this thing called alcoholism and get me going, you know, let me go. 7 years ago, guys, I had my gallbladder removed. Yeah, haven't thought about it since. Don't hang out with other gallbladder sufferers. Don't go to meetings with Gallbladder Anonymous. You know what I mean? Don't have gallbladderism. It's gone. You know what I mean? They took it out. Haven't thought about it since. Illness is taken care of. Life goes on. What's up with this thing called alcoholism? Why can't this be like that? You know what I mean? No. We suffer from illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Only. I guess I gotta give me one of them. I gotta give me one of them their spiritual experiences you guys are talking about. Because it's the only thing that's gonna conquer this thing. So far, said it. We must have some form of moral psychology. It's urgent importance. Urgent. Urgent. Like right now, you know. Nothing to wait. No time, you know. Unless we experience some sort of psychic change, there's very little hope for our recovery. Only a spiritual experience will conquer this thing. So I guess I was wasting my time bringing my alcoholism to Mass General. I did that for a lot of years. 12 to be exact. Saw a lot of psychiatrists. Saw a lot of psychologists. A lot of group therapies. You know what I mean? You guys, bringing my alcoholism to the psychiatrist is like bringing a jellyfish to an orthopedic surgeon. This ain't a lot of bones to work with in there, you know what I mean? But that's what we do. That's what I did, you know? I'm not going to get a spiritual experience there, you guys. I'll get a psychiatric experience. I had that. I'll get a psychological experience. Yep, I got that. And with any luck, I'll get a pharmaceutical one if I can get a script or two walking out the door, because that really was the goal. Give me something, Doc, you know? I'm not going to find a spiritual experience there. You know what else this guy told me? Off comes this jacket. Hold on a second, guys. I'm going to sweat to death up here. My shirt's all wrinkled, so I'm... You know what else he told me? He told me. This book tells me. The book tells me. It's a big, big book, too. I can't even pick it up. He's a big one. You know what else he told me? He said, we suffer from illness, which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And we only get two choices. Believe me, guys, I looked for a third. I searched for a third, you know. Two choices, that's it. It's like a game show. Hey, Dave, behind door number one, life based upon spiritual principles. Behind door number two, doomed to an alcoholic death. And I'm like, what do I do? Which way do I get? Can I phone a friend? Someone out there, help me with this, could you? You know what I mean? And that's us. That's you too. You did it too. You did it too. You know what I mean? It's like I'm asking myself, just how bad is an alcoholic death out to be, you know, before I decide. Tell me, how bad does it get, you know? That's our choices. Those are the two we get. The sponsor, thank God, he pointed that out to me. You know, I look at those 12 years in and out. When I first got here, you guys, I had to look at that. When I first got here, what mistakes did I make? I had to switch up a little bit. What do I have to change around a little bit this time around? Well, first of all, here's one of them. In 1989, I'm 29 years old when I first got here. Okay, on the outside, it looks pretty good. I'm practicing law on the North Shore of Boston. I've been doing so for about 4 years at this point. On the outside, it looks pretty good. Now, make sure you see it looks pretty good. I work hard at letting you see it looks pretty good. Matter of fact, that's a full-time job, making it look pretty good. You know? I'll show you I'll show you my nice career. I'll tell you all about it. I'll show you the beautiful car I'm driving. I'll take you back to a nice apartment. I'll be wearing $800 suits. And I'll show you all the trappings of my success. But the one thing I won't show you, because I didn't even know it was there to show you, but it was there, guys. It was there without a doubt, was this hole in the soul this wide. That all the drink and the drug in the world just didn't seem to be able to fill. And there was something wrong. And I didn't know what it was. You know? So I look at those 12 years when I came here in the very beginning. And I came here simply and solely because I was about to lose my job. So I look at those 12 years and I say to myself, what do I have to do this time around a little different than I didn't do then? You know, the first thing I did is I walked through that door for the first time. I walked in here thinking I know more about this thing than all you people combined. Thanks very much. You know, I finally figured out there's nothing to figure out. It's all been figured out for us. I just need a little direction. But, you know, I didn't have that. I was too smart for you people. Too smart for my own good, to be quite honest with you. You know? I didn't need your direction. I didn't need your help. I didn't need your guidance. I didn't need your sponsorship. You know? Your big book? Too big for me, thanks. I'm not reading it. Seriously, I thought it was a novel. Light reading for the alcoholic. I had no idea what you people would do with that thing, but I know this much. I wasn't picking it up. You know, thank God I had a guy say to me after meeting one time, he comes up and he says, Dave, can I ask you a question? I go, yeah, what's up? He goes, do you have a sponsor? I go, no, why? He goes, let me just say something to you, Dave, and I don't mean it to be respectful, but I never met anyone too dumb for this program, but my God, we bury butt heads like you all the time. Guys that are just too smart for their own good. We'll take a little direction, a little guidance, a little sponsorship from someone who maybe just maybe knows a little bit more about this deal than you do. Here's another mistake I made, you guys. First of all, not letting any of you guys help me. Not letting any of you guys show me down this path. Matter of fact, not even wanting to walk down the path. Why? Because I came in here convinced drinking was my problem. And for the sake of this conversation, let's call it the drink, the drug, and all the things like it, because the drug and all the things like it followed right behind the drink for me. I don't care what your drink or your drug really is. It doesn't matter to me. All I know is it didn't fill my hole. So I came in here convinced drinking was... Well, why wouldn't I? Everyone in my life is telling me I got a drinking problem. My mom and dad are telling me I got a drinking problem. My brothers and sisters are telling me I got a drinking problem. The best friends in my life, who, by the way, are no longer in my life, are telling me I got a drinking problem. My coworkers are telling me, my bosses are telling me, my clients are telling me I got a drinking problem, you know? It's getting bad out there, you know? You know? So I come in here in 89 and I said to myself, okay, fine. Fine, fine. You know, if that's what it is, if that's all I gotta do, I got a drinking problem, and all I gotta do is take the drink out of the equation, problem solved. I just stopped drinking. My sponsor this time around, he said, you got a drinking problem, Dave? Quit drinking. Quit drinking. And if after you quit drinking, you find you still have a problem, maybe the drink wasn't a problem to begin with, Dave, maybe you're the problem. You know, I wasn't a problem drinker, guys. I was an answer drinker. Life was the problem. Drinking was the answer. It was my solution. I thought all I had to do was stop drinking. I said I quit drinking. That's all I thought I had to do. Take the drink out of the equation. Problem solved. You guys, when you take my drink away, you see, if you're the hope and the soul alcoholic, if you're the real alcoholic, if you're the alcoholic of the hopeless right that Big Book talks about, and I am that guy, you see, guys, when you take my drink away, you did not just solve my problem. You just started it. I wasn't a problem drinker. I was a problem sober. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to learn how to quit drinking. I'll be the first one to tell you, I love drinking. Well, everything about it, to be quite honest. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous this time around to see if you guys could show me how to not feel the way I felt when I wasn't drinking. I know how to quit. I quit 1,000 times. Can you guys show me how to stay quit? Can you guys show me how to not start again? Can you guys show me how to stay quit? And how about this? Stay comfortable doing it? Because that's that I don't know how to do. You see, because there's relief in that bottle. There's magic in that bottle. There's something in that bottle I don't find anywhere else in my life. And there's a solution lies to me in that bottle. And I'm going to go to it. I was an answer drinker. You guys know what I'm talking about. Drinking was the answer for you, too. So drinking solves the problem. You know, he said in the body, your best buddy comes in, he goes, oh, he's all bummed out, what's the matter? He goes, just lost a job, what's the first thing I do? Let me buy you a drink. It's like 5 drinks later, who needs work, I got employment, I'm good, yeah, it's all good, you know, drink solved the problem. Your buddy comes in, what's the matter? She left me, oh my God, buy him a drink. You know, it's 6 drinks later, screw the bitch, you need her, you know, drink solved the problem. Drink solved the problem for me. The drink, seriously, it took care of my alcoholism for a lot of years, you know? And it was bad, and I had crossed some magic line somewhere along the way, you guys. To be quite honest with you, that's the way it went for me for the very first night. Let's go back to 13 years old, 1973, Patchy Wood, Reading, Massachusetts, before junior high school years. Let's go back to that night, that monumental, life-changing night, when I was 13 years old and drank for the first night. What a huge, huge night it is to think that all these years later I'm sitting in Tampa, Florida talking about it, you know what I mean? Who'd have thought, you know? I'm going to a teenage junior high school theater from Friday night, 7 to 9, I'm drinking, you know? But what a night it was. Now, I had all the pains, pressures, and problems. I had all the fears, doubts, and insecurities any 13-year-old kid would have. I take that back. I had a few extra thrown my way. I was the goofiest-looking kid you ever saw. You know, the triple-lens glasses, the big nose, the buck teeth, 6'1" by the age of 7. You know what I mean? We all had one in every class. I was him. You know, that was me. You know? And I'm telling you guys, I don't know what happened. Don't get me wrong. This is 25 years and $25,000 later. And I'm not done yet. You betcha, I'm not done yet. My uncle's goofing on me. Uncle Paul, you didn't know right to goof on this face. I spent $25,000 on this face. He says, what happened, Dave? You run out of money? I go, oh, you bastard. You know? But something happened that night, you guys, in those woods that night. I don't know what it was. You know? And it's not like the glasses fell off. It's not like the nose shrunk. The teeth didn't straighten. You know, I didn't lose 4 inches. You know what happened that night? The fear went away. The fear went away. And I discovered that I liked the world around me better when I was drinking. I discovered that night I liked you people better when I was drinking. I discovered that night I liked myself better when I was drinking. And I made a decision that night, and I didn't even know I was making it. I knew this isn't the night I was going to make that drink the most important thing in my life. And to keep that drink the most important thing in my life, I'm going to pay a lot of prices. And you guys know what I'm talking about. My seat in Alcoholics Anonymous did not come free. I paid for that seat. I paid for that seat in ways that I can't even begin to describe to you how I paid for my seat in here. What it cost me to walk through that door and take that chair. And you all know what I'm talking about. Not one of you came in here without paying the price too. Willingly or unwilling, we were paying a price. You know? I heard a speaker one time say it, I can relate. 21 years old, I walk into a package store downtown Boston. I make that 12-pack of Budweiser, please. The guy plops it down in front of me and says, kid, that'll cost you $8.95 in every real friendship you've ever had. Sounds about right. I'll pay that. 31 years old, walk into a bar like a shot in the beer, please. That would cost you $8, mister, in your marriage. Sounds about right. I'll pay that. I was 41 years old, you guys. I walked in a package store downtown Boston. I wanted that fifth of tequila, the mezcal, the one with the worm. Yep. That's the only one I want, right there, top shelf, please. He puts it down in front of me and says, that'll cost you $17.95. And your license to practice law in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Sounds about right. I'll pay it. I paid it. So do you. So do you. The price you pay. Your career. Every material possession you ever had. Every relationship that ever meant anything to you. How about your freedom? Did you pay that? You pay the prices. I don't even know I'm paying them. But I pay them. Because what's in that bottle is worth more to me than my career, than my friendships. I didn't want to tell my parents to drink more to me than they did, but it did. I didn't want to tell my brothers and sisters to drink more to me than they did, but it did. I didn't want to tell the best friends of my life that meant more to me. I didn't want to tell every job I ever had, every career I ever had. I didn't want to say to drink more to me than those things did, but it did. I didn't want to tell the drink more to me everything in my material possession that I ever had in my entire life, but it did. I would burn my life to the ground two times over to keep that drink in my hand. That's exactly what I did. I paid the price. And that's the way it would go. So I get through high school. I get through college. 4-year blackout. That's all that was. Eat, sleep, drink, and study. And I do it again the same way. God damn it. I love those years. Jesus, I love my college years. Ooh, that was the best. You know? So I graduate 4 years later with a degree in economics and in a cocaine addiction. And off I go to law school. You know what I mean? Because I didn't want to go to work. That's basically why. So I do the law school thing. Pass the bar. Now I'm working. And now it's age 28, 29. That's when it's really starting to fall apart. Unmanageability is now ruling. The drink is now in total control. I no longer have any choice in the matter. The power of choice is now long gone. Life around me is crumbling. I don't know why. I can't understand it. I don't know what to do about it. I'm living one might say to drink. I'm getting relief from the bottle still. I'm not willing to put it down. I see it's destroying everything good in my life. And I don't know quite what to do about it. And my friends are starting to call me on it. And when my friend would call me on my drink, and I had to do one or two things. Number one, I got to talk you out of your position. You know, so we can hang. Or two, I got to get you out of my way. because you're calling me on the most important thing in my life. I'm not putting this down for you. I will step over you, I will step around you, I will step on you, but you're not taking it away. And that's what was going on. In the beginning, if drinking was something I was doing once in a while, you know, sprinkling around my lifetime, at the age of 29, life was something I was doing once in a while, sprinkled around my drinking. My family couldn't count on me. Work was a joke. My friends, they wanted nothing to do with me. And I'm just drinking. And I can't stop it. And it got to the point where, you know, it's a Tuesday night. I promised myself I'm going to be home by 11. Yeah. You know what I got to do tomorrow. I got to try it tomorrow. It's a big day tomorrow. I know. I'm not drinking to escape reality. I know my reality. I'm not doing that. You know, but I'm going out at 11 o'clock, and they've got my friends at 11 o'clock, they're going home. And it's like, where are you guys going? It's only 11, you know. They're leaving the bar because they can leave the bar. I'm rude to my boss, too. Why am I rude to my boss, too? Why is it every bar I've been, why does it have to be flashing before I'm leaving? What's up with that? I don't know. Thank you, Dr. Soakworth. He explained to me many things to which I couldn't have before account. Now I understand what was going on. Soakworth explained it to me. I have an allergy to alcohol. I have this mental obsession and this physical craving that makes it impossible for me to get out of that bar stool. Why I wasn't getting off the bar stool? Because I couldn't. When I started drinking at 7, there's no way I'm going to be done at 11. When I start drinking today, there is no tomorrow. That's my experience. That's what happens to me. So 2 o'clock comes and goes, you know, lights are flashing, you've got to go, but it ain't over, and you know it ain't over. I'm grabbing 10 of you, we're going back to my place. We'll do all those things we got to do to keep us drinking all night long. 8 o'clock in the morning, gets up, finally we're at 8 o'clock in the morning, damn it. I get up from the dining room table, I take a shower, I put a suit on, now I'm trying to drive to work. Now I'm trying to drive to the office. Now I'm trying to drive to the courthouse to represent you in that OUI. Sorry. You know? It's getting bad out there, what's going on. You know, and that's when it all fell apart. The bosses said, get sober, you get out. I knew if I lost that job, I'd be unemployed and unemployable. So to save my job, and simply and solely to save my job, I jumped on a plane July 5th, 1989, 29 years old, flew out of Boston. I went out to Pennsylvania to send 28-day rehab. And don't get me wrong, God put a lot of God-inspired men and God-inspired women right in front of me, directly in front of me, carrying a message of hope and a message of love, a message of recovery, a message of the 12 steps, an unconditional message of love and service that we talk about now called Synonymous. They were carrying a message of God, and I was hearing none of it. I was hearing none of it. Why? Because you cannot say the right thing to someone who's not ready to hear the message. I don't know who we are supposed to hear what I got to say tonight. It's not our job to know who's supposed to hear what we got to say tonight. It's simply our job to show up and make it available because that's all we are. Message to every business, to make it available business. They were making it available to those of us who wanted it. I didn't. If you're only inquiring for memberships, the desire to stop drinking, well, that's a wonderful thing, except I didn't have one of them. I had 3 bosses who had a desire I stopped drinking. I didn't have it, though. You know, so it didn't work for me. You could have Dr. Bog to my left, but Wilson to my right, and Lois pouring coffee, and I wasn't going to hear a thing during those 28 days. But the place was beautiful. It was an old resort. It used to be a hotel, built-in pool, tap all 3, signed me up, you know what I mean? I loved it. 28 days I spent out here. Here's the best memory. You know, we did arts and crafts. I remember like it was yesterday. Huge long table, 17 guys my age, up and down the East Coast, sitting in this thing, at a moment of clarity. It's like, you guys, what is wrong with this picture? You know, tell me what's wrong with this picture. I'm a 29-year-old attorney from Boston sitting in the middle of Effort of Pennsylvania on a Wednesday morning at 10:30 doing spin art. Help me, please. Shoot me, please, you know. Someone shoot me now. Oh, could you please pass the purple? It's like, help me with this, you know what I mean? That's the best memory I got for 28 days of this room, you know. So there it is, 28 days later, 15 pounds heavier, some nice artwork under my arm, you know, and I'm back in Boston. And what am I doing in Boston 28 days later, I'm shouting from the hilltops, recovery, recovery, I'm in recovery, like I know what it is, you know what I mean? Like I have any clue what it means. I'm not in recovery, you guys, I'm just not drinking for a week maybe, or a week or 2 or 3, maybe if I'm lucky. I'm as long as I can suffer through it, that's as far as I get, you know? And I think just because I'm not drinking, I'm in recovery, you guys, I know my solution to my drunkenness is sobriety. The solution to my alcoholism is recovery, and here's the difference. I didn't have that going on. And I wasn't asking any of you to show me the difference, so I wasn't going to figure it out on my own. And I know today that book's not hard to read. This path is not hard to follow. Those steps aren't hard to take. Unless you're reading it alone, walking it alone, or taking them alone. That was me for 12 years, trying to do this thing all by myself. You know, I'm coming to your meetings on a nightly basis. I'm looking around saying, oh my God, please, tell me there's more to my life than this. If all I have to look forward to is hot coffee on cold metal chairs, hiding out in church basements the rest of my life, you guys, shoot me now. I ain't going to make it. I ain't going to make it. I know I'm not going to make it. You know, but that's what it was. You know, and every stretch of sobriety I had was marked with misery. Every stretch of sobriety was marked with uncomfortability. I was restless. I was irritable. I was discontent, and I didn't even know it. You know, and I wouldn't let you see it. I'd bluff it. You know, I wasn't letting you see it because I wasn't telling you. You know, I'm raising my hand. I'm telling you I'm alcoholic. I don't even know what one is. I have no idea what defines us. I have no idea why we're what we are. I'm just coming to your meetings and suffering through. You know, fast forward for a minute. Let me give you a classic example of God using us with or without our permission. I'm 2 weeks sober. It's November 2001. I'm in a place down Cape Cod, Massachusetts. I'm in a rehab place down that place. The first day I got there, I'm standing out back having a cigarette, and a counselor's aide with a cane named Joe. This guy Joe, my God. Talk about God using that guy that night. Talk about being an instrument, willing or unwilling, conscious or unconscious instrument of a power greater than himself. And I say that because of this. Joe and I had a smoke that night, and he talked to me. And if he was standing here beside me tonight, I said, hey, Joe, remember that conversation that night when you said that, da 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 da? And all likelihood, he'd probably look at me and say, you know, Dave, I don't quite remember that. 9 years later, guys, I'm still talking about it. You know what he said? He said, David, if all you're doing Alcoholics Anonymous, if all you're doing here is just not drinking, if all you're doing here is just looking for one more day of sobriety, if all you're doing here is just hanging in there, fighting the fight, monkey on your back, you're shooting for midnight, and you think that's all we have to offer, if that's all you're doing, Dave, and you're doing nothing whatsoever to change the man you brought in here, you're taking no action whatsoever to change the person you brought in here, you're doing nothing whatsoever other than just not drinking, and you think that's all we're supposed to be doing here. He goes, my God, Dave, how long can you hold your breath? How long can you hold your breath doing nothing to change the man you brought in? It's just a matter of time, Dave. How long can you hold your breath before you're going to pick a drink back up again? And he was right. The best I had, 3 years. During that 12-year stretch, you guys, I held my breath for 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, taking no action whatsoever. And at the end of those 3 years, I did what anyone else in this room whose relapse has also done. You did what I did. Whether you stayed sober for a week, whether you stayed sober for a month, whether you stayed sober for a year, whether you stayed sober for a decade, if you relapsed, you did what I did after those 3 years. I made a sober decision. A sober decision. Had to be a sober decision. Then I had one in 3 years. I made a sober decision to pick a drink back up again. Holding that drink in my hand after 3 years without one, taking was not my problem. Same with you. After your week, after your month, after your year, after your decade, you made the same thing. You made a sober decision to pick that drink up again. Holding that drink in your hand, drinking wasn't your problem that night either. You know what your problem was that night? It was the same thing as me. It was my sobriety. My ugly, miserable, untreated, I can't stand it for another second sobriety and my inability to live comfortably in it. I was solving the wrong problem. You want to know the leading cause of relapse? Sobriety. It is. Every time I relapse, it's my sobriety. I can't stand it. I can't stand my sobriety. Powerless, I was going out for the weekend. I remember. I told my friends, I'll be back Monday. Just give me one more Saturday. Let me black out one more time. Just one more good blackout. That's all I was looking for. You know what I mean? You know? And that weekend lasted 9 years. And during those 9 years, I burned my life to the ground 2 times over and destroyed everything good in it. You know? Because here's what happens to me. You see? Here's what happens to me. Because when sobriety's my problem, what I'll do is I'll change that drink. And I'll drink till I can stand that no more. Then I'll get sober till I can stand that no more. Then I'll drink till I can stand that no more. Sober till I can stand that no more. Before you know it, there goes a decade of my life. Another decade of my life is gone. And left in my path is a wake of destruction a mile wide because I blow like a tornado through the lives of everyone who loves me and wake up maybe if I'm lucky yet again in another detox, another rehab, another let's call it what it is, another nut house saying, my God, what happened? What happened? I don't get another one of them in me. I don't want to do that again. I'm tired of building it up from the scratch. I'm tired of trying to rise from the ashes, because that's all I got left. I'm tired of that. That big book is right. You told us, and you were absolutely right. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. In the end, it's November 2001. I'm a shell of a man I used to be. I've lost another partnership, another six-figure income gone overnight. I'm tossed out. I'm trying to put a law practice together by day while I'm walking the streets of Boston at night doing whatever came next to get the drink. Doing whatever came next to get the drink. Every real friend of my life is gone. Tears in my parents' eyes on a nightly basis put there by my actions that I'm absolutely powerless over stopping. My parents are not alcoholic, but they suffered from alcoholism. Mine. This is not about me. This is no longer about me. I'm living in the delusion that it's all about me, but believe me, guys, it is not about me. And alcoholism affected a lot of people. My brothers and sisters, wonderful people, they don't want me in their houses anymore. They don't want me near their kids. They don't want me near my nieces and nephews. You know? My bottle's empty, my wallet's empty, my pipe's empty, my life is empty. I'm a walking shell of the man I used to be. Every bit of potential, ambition, and drive I once had are long gone. I can't even get out of bed, guys, unless I know there's a drink or a drug waiting for me. You know, honor and dignity are lost in the dust of my addiction. My morals and values are warped beyond any sense of recognition. I don't even know who I am anymore. You know, I'm living, one might say, to drink. And when I live like that, I got to drink like that. And when I drink like that, I got to live like that. And it's just the way it goes. I'm getting relief out of the bottle, but it's short-lived, but I still need it. I heard a speaker talk about those first 8 minutes. The first 8 minutes and the what I'm willing to pay to get them. Forget about the misery and destruction and everything that follows. Just give me those first 8 minutes. I know what he meant. My last night out there was a Wednesday night, November 14, 2001. A night like any other for me. I cop an 8-ball, I smoke it, I bang back a fifth of tequila so I can forget about you and the rest of the world. And I end up at some dive bar up in Lowell, Massachusetts. And I close that bar like I closed every bar I've ever been in. And lights are flashing, bartenders, there, gotta go, Dave, you gotta go, dude, Dave, you gotta go. You know, and I had no idea as I kicked back that last drink, as I took that last sip, and I put that empty glass down on that bar, I had no idea that would be my last drink to date. I did not know, believe me, I did not plan this path. From that moment to this, you guys, I guarantee you, I have not planned this path. I didn't chart this course. I did not design this destiny. I had nothing to do with this. Trust me when I tell you, you know. Had I known that was going to be my last drink, I would have ordered two. I guarantee you, you know, I would have ordered two. I've been living a plan, not my own. I firmly believe God has a plan with every one of my names on it. Just a matter of what's going to happen to get your will out of the way so His can take place. So His can take place. You know, I put that glass down the bar. My plan was just to come back tomorrow and do it all over again. I went home and passed out that night. And that will give you a pretty good idea of what this alcoholic was like. Here's what happened. On the morning of Thursday, November 15, 2001, my sobriety date, I woke up at 5:30 in the morning to a knock on the door, like any other knock I've ever heard in my entire life, and on the other side of the door stood the FBI, the DEA, two state and two local, looking for me. I was part of a federal sting that morning. I was arrested, 38 of us from Miami to Boston. We were arrested that morning by the feds, 17 of us in Boston. You know, the next thing you know, I'm standing in front of the United States Federal District Court, downtown Boston, waterfront, locally building, nightmare, an absolute nightmare. United States of America versus David W. Perry. Now, they're the captions of a lifetime, huh, wouldn't you say? You know, the one I've been waiting for my whole career is now facing me right in my, you know, and if you were standing next to me, you would have heard me tell you this is the worst day of my life. Charges, conspiracy to possess and distribute, oh my God, 500 kilograms of cocaine. Kilograms. I buy 8-balls. And if I wrote kilograms, like, can I see one? Can I just touch one? What are you talking about, you know? You got to be kidding me, you know? Seriously, you haven't seen, like, an 8 Colombian to the left, 8 Colombian to the right, here's Dave Perry in the middle. It's like, what happened, you know? How did this happen, you know? And the judge is telling us the charges carry 10 to life. And the judge is telling us that there's not going to be any bail set for any one of us. And the judge is telling us, I got to go to jail. I'm devastated. If I was standing beside you that day, I would have told you this is the undisputed, without a doubt, worst day of my life. I flew down to Tampa tonight, you guys, to tell you I don't quite look at it that way anymore. I came down here to Tampa tonight, you guys, to tell you guys I firmly believe with every cell in my body that that is the undisputed greatest event that's ever happened in my life. And I'm also here to tell you without 1 ounce of reservation that I firmly believe with every cell in my body that God sent those men. I don't know what gets you in your seats tonight. I can only assume a little bit of pain followed along the way. I heard a speaker one time say it. If you're new tonight, you probably haven't had a very good year. You know? I'm sure there's a little pain that followed your way in the door. God knows I had a little bit of mine. I do know the worst day of my life. 2 days later, Saturday, November 17, 2001. I'm down in Plymouth County Correctional Facility in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And I'm in a room probably about twice the size of this. 80 bunk beds spread across the place. They called it New Man. It's where you go before you get placed into our individual cells over the course of the next 2 or 3 days. And I'm sitting on my bunk, and from myself to the coffee pot away, I'm staring at the wall. This is 50 years to the day my mom and dad are married, and 50 years to the day we're celebrating their wedding anniversary back in Reading. Well, the fact that I'm not at this family party does not make this the worst day of my life. This is nothing new. Missing family events, that's nothing new. The reason it's the worst day of my life is I'm sitting in that bunk, and I'm staring across the wall, and on the wall is the payphone. And you guys, I'm realizing for the first time in my life, even if I wanted to get up across, if I wanted to get up and walk across that room and pick up that payphone, I had no one left in my life to call. No one. I've never been more alone in my life than I was at that very moment. Every real friend is gone. My parents can't stop crying. My brothers and sisters want nothing to do with me. And I am by myself. I heard a woman one time say it. She asked me that question. Have you found that place in your life where you've got no place left to go but to God? Have you found it yet? Have you realized that there's no power on earth, there's no human power on earth that's going to relieve us of our alcoholism? You know what we're really doing here, our job here is really quite simply this. We need to find a power by which we can live, and it has to be a power greater than ourselves, you guys. Are you there yet? Or is there still a little power left in you? So long as you got a little power left in you, you ain't powerless. And if you ain't powerless, guys, then you don't need to go look for one. And this thing won't work. If you're not done, go get done. The book tells you that. Go get done. We'll be here for you when you get back. You know? And I don't know what my prayer was that night sitting on that bunk. It was simple as God, what's wrong with me? But whatever my prayer was, it got answered. 2 days later, I got pulled out of that cell, brought back before that judge, and they put me in the Federal Pretrial Services Division. I'm here but for the grace of God and the compassion of the federal government. But I had a court slip too. They gave me a chance to find recovery if I wanted it. She said, meaning this thing means absolutely nothing, Mr. Perry. Obviously, you need what these people have. We'll give you a chance to get it if you want it. You still have to answer to the charges, but we'll give you a shot. And from there, I put that down to a detox for 10 days, 4.5 months in a therapeutic community, into a halfway house in Boston, then off to a sober house. And for the next 8 months, it would be just like the 12 years before, my sobriety sucked. I was suffering from untreated sobriety, untreated alcoholism, another bad case of sobriety going on in my life. I'm suffering through your meetings. I'm not drinking for one reason and one reason only, fear. You just stay sober out of fear? Anyone got a probation officer or a court case hanging over your head? Angry spouse, huh? How about your employer jumping on your back? You know what I'm talking about. But fear is not our solution. It's not what's going to last. It's only a temporary thing. If I pick up a drink, the federal marshals are picking me up, and I'm going back to jail, so I'm not drinking out of fear. Bill Wilson talked about it. Fear sobered him for a bit. Page 8, check it out. But not for long, you know? And that's exactly what my experience. First 8 months of my sobriety, I turned my will and my life over to the care of the feds. It's God's plan, not mine. I didn't choose it. But another miracle happened to me on July 21st, 2002, 8 months sober. That's when God put me back in my life. An old friend of mine called me up. Now, I knew this guy back in the 90s. He was sober when I was sober, in and out, in and out, but he stayed in. In 97, he moved out of Boston down to Baltimore. He couldn't get sick. He needed his family's help. He went down to Baltimore. 97, he left Boston, moved back down to Baltimore. And in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Glen Burnie, Maryland, he heard a man take a podium in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this guy, this man, carried a message of hope. This man carried a message of love. This man carried a message of the 12 steps, a message of recovery. And my friend went up to him after that meeting and said, "I've never heard it said quite like that. Will you show me what you're talking about?" And with that said, my friend started following that man down the path. 5 years later, he heard that I had been arrested. I was back in treatment as a result of that arrest. He called me up and says, "Dave, I'm coming to Boston. I'm coming up to Logan. I'm flying into Logan on Sunday morning, July 21st, 2002. I'm going up to Olympusaki up in New Hampshire. My sister's got a cottage for a week. I'm going to go spend 3 days. You want to go?" This is a little vacation. That's all I thought it was. 3 days was no fun. I said, "Hell yeah, I'll go." I had no idea God was sending me my sponsor. I had no idea. I get to Logan, I pick him up. Here he comes, he gets in my car. "You guys, this guy's coming at me. He looks different, he sounds different, he acts different. He is different, he's inexplicably different. There's something about his eyes. He was fresh-skinned and glowing. The exact same experience Bill Wilson describes near the end of that bleak November in 1934 is the exact same experience I had on July 21st, 2002 when my buddy got in my car. We started driving, he started telling me in a general way what he was like, what happened to him, what he was like now. He started talking about these steps. He talked about his recovery. He talked about the changes in his life that were happening. And he talked about the new feeling and new experience he was experiencing as a result of taking these steps. And he asked me if I wanted to come along. He asked me if I wanted what he had. He said, 'My job's real simple, Dave. If you want what I got, I'll show you how to do it.' He goes, 'What you really got to do, Dave, you've had it all wrong for so long. Let me just tell you the way it should be, the way you got to understand it. You see, Dave, you're under the mistaken impression that what you need to do is you need to get your life straightened out before you can go out there and start helping others.' He says, 'No, Dave, that's just that. You got to go out there and start helping others in order to get your life in order.' He said it straight out, 'Dave, what you need to do is you need to find God.' And then, no, Steve, I need to find an attorney. I need to find a loan, a new career. I got a long list of things I need to find. This guy's talking about prayers and inventories. I'm looking for lawyers and loans, you know what I mean? I'm not seeing it eye to eye. I said, 'You're going to be kidding me, Steve. I got real problems here. I got federal charges hanging over my head that carry 10 to life. I'm about to be disbarred by the Massachusetts Bar Association. I've lost everything real in my life. My parents can't stop crying. I've destroyed everything good. I've lost everything good. I don't have a friend left in the world, and you're telling me I got to go find God? Come on, Steve, give me something real. Give me something I can see. Give me something I can feel. Give me something I can touch, dude. I'm not just hearing this. I got to see. You got to be kidding me.' He says, 'Dave, if you just follow me down this, if you just trust me on this one, if you just let me show you a different way, a way you haven't seen before, I guarantee you every one of those problems, one by one by one by one by one, will be solved, and you will not solve one of them. You will not solve them because you can't.' That's the day I stood at the turning point, you guys. At that very moment, I was at the turning point. My half measures of Bill mean nothing. My old ideas were killing me, and I had to get rid of them, and I had to get rid of them all. And unless and until I did, the results would be nil. Nil. I had to follow. I had no other choice. And I said to him, 'But I've been around, Steve. I've seen these 12 steps. Every meeting I go, there they are, hanging on the wall. I've seen them. I've had them every meeting I hear about them talking about. I'll be honest with you, Steve. I don't understand how those steps work. I don't agree those steps are going to work. I don't even believe they're going to work. I said, 'How do you do these steps if you don't understand them? How do you do these steps if you don't agree with them? How do you do these steps if you don't even believe they're going to work for you?' He said, 'That's just it, David. You don't have to understand these steps to make them work. You don't have to agree these steps to make them work. You have to believe they're going to work to make them work. They're principles. They're going to work no matter what you agree with, no matter what you agree with, no matter what you understand, and no matter what you believe.' I said, 'How do you do them if you don't understand or agree or believe?' He says, 'All you have to do is simply become willing to follow a person who has already done them. It's that simple, Dave. The greatest promise in this book is on page 58, you guys. Really, have we seen it? Really, have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path?' He said, 'Can you walk behind me down a path? Can you follow right behind me down a path? Can you stay 3 feet behind me down a path, Dave? You don't have to say what I say, you don't have to think what I think, but if you do what I do, you're going to get what I got, because this is a program of action.' He says, 'Dave, you see, the problem isn't about what you haven't said. It's not what you haven't heard. It's not what you haven't read. It's not what you haven't seen. It's not what you haven't studied. It's all about what you haven't done, Dave. There's a whole bunch of things to do. We get directions laid out on exactly what you need to do. The problem with you is that you haven't done them. How am I going to come to that 12-step program, David, and ignore these 12 steps? I said, you want me to get involved with these steps with you? Is that what you're telling me? I said, when do you want me to start? He says, when do you want to recover? I said, now. And there, on that morning, Sunday, July 21st, 2002, my journey from sobriety into recovery began. When I had the willingness to follow a man unconditionally and without question down this path, I stayed 3 feet behind him. And don't buy into the bullshit. You don't have to wait. Nowhere in that book does it say we have to wait. If anyone's telling you to wait, they're not reading the same book I am. If you decide you want what you have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, you're ready. You're ready. The 100 men and women made it clear. If anyone's telling you different, run. It's my experience. You don't have to wait. And you need to actually get you immediate results. I started following him. I took his hand. I trusted him. I walked down the path right behind him, and I did exactly what he told me to do. He didn't just tell me. He showed me. By 3 that afternoon, we're pulling my car to the side of the road. I'm getting out. I'm turning to page 63, and I'm taking the third step. The most powerful, the most life-changing prayer that I've ever said in my entire life is on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The day I met God. The day I took on a new employer. The day I became an agent of God. That's all we are. Paper boys and paper girls for God. Agents of God. He writes it, we carry it. That's all we're doing. Secret agents for God. That's all we are. You know? Now, I had no idea I was taking on the role. I had no idea the impact it would have on my life. You guys, I am here tonight at your invitation. Thank you very much. But to be honest with you, God sent me. I'm just doing my job. I'm doing my third step. I took on a new employer, and part of my job duties today was to come to Tampa and carry the message. I'm showing up for my boss. He sent me here today. That's all this is. And if I'm willing to do that on a daily basis, if I'm willing to look to my new employer, my boss, and ask him, what do you want me to do today? My life gets good. And my life stays good. But it's just like any other job. Don't expect to get paid if you don't show up for 3 weeks. Don't come by looking for a paycheck, guys. I ain't waiting for you, you know what I mean? This is just like any, this is real stuff. This is real life stuff. I got a boss I call God today. I ask him in the morning what he wants me to do, and to the best of my ability, I go do it. And when I do that, he gives me everything I need. I had no idea what I was saying. I had no idea on July 21st the impact that would have on my life. Today, 9 years later, and a whole bunch of men and women sponsored since, I know exactly what he means. You know? I got back in the car, I felt great. I said, wow, Steve, that was awesome. I just took a third step. Yes! Let's get some dinner. He goes, no, let's get a notebook. He took me to a country store. He made me go in. I bought a pen and a paper. I got back in the car, and he gave me directions on writing a 4-star. I was starving. I was hungry. And I was. He wouldn't let me eat. I had to go buy a notebook and a pen and gave me simple, clear-cut direction on how to write a 4-step. Looked just like the one on page 65. Exactly like it, to be quite honest with you. I wrote about my resentments. I wrote about my fear. I put my sex conduct down on paper. I withheld nothing. And over the next 2 days, I read my 5th step. Now the problem is, it's 3 days later. We're back at Logan. He's jumping on the plane. He's flying back to Baltimore. I go, wait a minute. How are you going to sponsor me from Boston to Baltimore? Don't you get to pick me up, give me rides, lend me money, and buy me cigarettes? How are you going to do that from Boston to Baltimore? You know? He said 2 words. Let's trust God. Let's trust God. Even the rest of the steps over the phone. Some guys will say you can't do that. Tell me wrong, but tell me recovered. Because it worked. I took directions from a man armed with the facts about himself, experience with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, exactly how they're laid out in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I crossed every T, I dotted every I, I took the directions exactly the way they were laid out, and my God, it worked. It took 3 more weeks to get through them with directions from this guy over the phone. And you know what I got? I got that spiritual awakening. The spirit that I was so dead when I got here, that was so flat and so absolutely lifeless when I first walked in these doors, slowly starts to come alive and awake. Not by what I say, not by what I read, not by what I study, all by what I do. And all because of who I help. because that's what this thing is really all about. My sponsor promised me if you stay about God's business, he'll stay about yours. And one by one by one by one, every of those problems I told you about will start to disappear. And 9 years later, I'm here to report, one by one by one by one, every one of those problems I had 9 years ago are today gone in my life. You know? I just did what he said. The spirit that was so dead when I got here slowly started to come alive and awaken. It started right away. You know? And he made it real clear. Every day is the day we have to carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. Every day is the day we carry the vision of God's will. I don't stay clean on yesterday's shower. I don't stay fed on yesterday's meal. I'm not staying physically fit on yesterday's workout at the gym. And I'm not staying spiritually fit on yesterday's action. If I want it today, guys, I got to do it today. And it's just that simple. If I want to get paid today, I got to show up for work today. And there's work to be done. There's work to be done. This is not a program for lazy people. It's just not. It's my experience. It's just not. You know? Check it out. The spiritual awakening. I walk into a bar. I grab me up a bartender. He hooks me up a drink and my spirits are lifted. Can you relate? I walk into Alcoholics Anonymous. I grab me up a sponsor. He hooks me up with God. And my spirits are lifted. Go figure. Same end result. Just a whole better way to get it. Why do they call them wine and spirits? You know? So that's what happened. I started taking this test. The spirit starts coming alive. And I finally can step out into a world. And I used to, a world that would otherwise terrify me. I can walk smooth with a drink in my hand. I'm now stepping back out to it. And I'm not miserable anymore, you guys. I'm finding happy sobriety. I'm getting comfortable with sobriety. This thing is starting to work. You know the greatest miracle? The greatest miracle? The greatest thing that's happened to me from July 21st, 2002 to wherever we are right now. What are we? What's our date? Well, I don't even know where we are. October 2010, right? Somewhere between that date and this, somewhere between that Sunday morning, July 21st, 2002, and this very moment where I stand tonight, somewhere in that little time frame, I woke up one morning and I realized my obsession to drink and drug, the most powerfully destructive force in my life, was gone. It's been removed. It doesn't exist today. I'm not here fighting the fight tonight. I'm not here hanging in tonight. No monkey on my back tonight. I'm not shooting for midnight, guys. I've been set free. I'm free. And it's been that way for almost 9 years running. What day did I wake up and found it was gone? I can tell you about all sorts of great dates in my life. I can talk about that first date I had a drink, and graduation dates, the day I passed the bar, the day I was disbarred. I can tell you about all these great dates in my life, you know what I mean? Why can't I tell you about the date that I woke up and found the obsession to drink and drug was removed? The reason why I can't tell you when that happened is because I had nothing to do with it. I didn't do it. Somewhere along the way, when I wasn't looking, God took it. He took it. And that's the miracle of it. The 10-step promises us that. That's the miracle of it. The miracle today is not the fact that I haven't had a drink, you guys. The miracle of my life today is the fact that I haven't wanted one. How about that? That's huge. So I got my sponsor. I got him on the phone. You know, he's right on the phone because that's what he got. I'm taking direction from my sponsor. I'm 3 weeks into the steps with him. He's in Baltimore. I'm in Boston. He's telling me, okay, what do you want? Okay, Steve, what's up for tonight? He goes, one more direction. He goes, where are you going? I go, I'm going to a meeting downtown. Tuesday night, I'm going to go to Crossroads over on Newbury Street. He goes, I want to give you a little direction. You ready? I go, I'm ready. What do you want me to do? He goes, tonight, David, I want you to walk into that meeting, but I want you to do a little something different. Tonight, when you walk into that meeting, instead of you walking into that meeting looking to see what you can take, because God knows you've been taking all your life, how about you walk into that meeting looking to see what you can bring? How about you find that girl in the corner who's all by herself shaking and let her know she never has to feel that way again? Find that brand new guy in the corner who's all by himself and let him know he never has to be alone again. He goes, I want you to start talking about these steps. I want you to start talking about your recovery. I want you to start talking about the actions you've been taking in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want you to start talking about the love and service that we've been teaching you and what God wants you to do in these steps. I want you to get out there and start carrying this message. Be the paper boy you're supposed to be for God. I mean, you've got to be kidding me, Steve. I'm not ready for that. I can't do that. I don't know it like you. Well, you're down in Baltimore. You've been doing this for 8 years down there. You sponsored I don't know how many people down there. I can't say it like you say it. I don't know it like you know it. I'm not ready for that. I'm not qualified. He says, David, I know you're not qualified. And you know you're not qualified. But that new guy in the corner's got no clue you're not qualified. Get over there and help him. And he's right. The guy's got no clue. I got no clue. You know what I mean? All he sees is my hand. And you see, the beauty of it is, I can't say the wrong thing to him if he's ready to hear the message. I can't say the right thing if he's not. You got 7 days? Go show that guy with 1 day how you got seven. You got 4 weeks? Go grab up that one guy with the week over there and show him how you got four. I'm not saying don't take him through the steps if you haven't been. Hold off on that. But my God, can you grab us up? Can you put your hand out? Can you just say hello? Can you introduce him to a few of your friends? Can you put him in your car and give him a ride home? Can you take her out for coffee tomorrow and start talking about what you've been doing? You know, it starts now, guys. It starts now. And if you're willing to let it start now, your life is going to change. My sponsor made it real clear. He says, remember, David, you are nothing but a paper boy. A is nothing but the message delivery business. You're in the making it available business. And you've got a gift that not many people have. You're in the message delivery business, and what you grab is a gift. Are you a faithful trustee of that gift, or do you got the busies? What's got you so damn busy, Dave? You're chasing the money, the property, the prestige. You chased those before. You had those before. They fill the hole. Besides, Dave, I saw you when you got out of detox. You didn't look too busy to me, you know? Let's get out there. Carry the message. That's all we're supposed to do. That's all we're supposed to do. And I heard a guy say it one time. He made it real clear. He said, I've been sober 20 years, and in my 20 years of sobriety, I've sponsored over 200 men, he said. 200 men with a 100% success rate. I go, 100% success rate? You gotta be shitting me. All my guys are drinking. He goes, no, don't get me wrong. A lot of my guys are drinking. Matter of fact, some of them are dead. But I've been happily, joyfully sober for these 20 years, and I call that 100% success. All right, just reach our hand up. Just put our hand up. You know what I discovered along the way, you guys, in these last 9 years? God is not a noun. He's a verb. It's not about what it is. It's about what I do. My spirit's awake. The message is real. And the solution's available. It's alive. And my prayer tonight is that if you're sitting in this room and you can relate to what I was talking about when I was sentenced to sobriety, sentenced to untreated alcoholism, suffering in sobriety, looking around saying, please tell me there's more to my life than this. If that's you tonight, bad case of sobriety going on, we're here for you. My sponsor told me carrying this message is not an option if you want recovery. It's an absolute requirement. There's men and women in this room whose lives depend upon carrying this message to you. Our lives depend upon reaching out to you. My back pocket is full of cards with my numbers on it. And I'll make myself available to anyone in this room who wants help. Apparently it works. God doesn't recognize state lines. Boston to Baltimore did me just fine. I reached my hand out to anyone in this room. But I know there's men and women in this room. I've been here before. I'm looking at a whole bunch of them who glow with this message. A message of hope, a message of recovery, and a message of unconditional love and service. A message of God. The miracle already happened, you guys. The victory happened. June 10th, 1935, when one alcoholic reached out to another alcoholic at a kitchen table in Akron, Ohio, and set the world on fire. 4 years later, about 100 men and women were all taking the same actions and getting the same results. And they wrote a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was published on April 1st, 1939. So the rest of the world could take those directions. Nothing better to report, nothing better to count of what they did. Directions that we could follow so we could get what they got, precisely what they got. And here we are 75 years later. And the only decision that you need to make in your life tonight is whether you want to take part in a wholesale miracle in your life that's already happening in millions and millions of ours. And my prayer is if that is you, let us show you how this thing works. I guarantee if you do that, the results will blow you away. They will absolutely blow you away. Thanks for having me up tonight.
Thank Thank you so much, Dave. Jeremiah to read a vision for you.
I'm Jeremiah, and I'm an alcoholic, and this is the end of a vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact about us, or for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us on the as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
This conference strongly believes in sponsorship. Will anyone that is willing and able to be a sponsor please raise your hand? If you do not have a sponsor, please see one of those people. Let's give a hand for both of our speakers one more time. And thank you, everyone, that has came and supported the There is a Solution conference. And will all of our committee members please stand up?
Yeah.
I want to thank all of the committee members for putting on this conference. If you would like to get involved with next year's conference, please see any of them. I think we're taking a 10-minute break before the question portion. Yeah? Okay. 10 minutes, and then speakers will answer questions. Is loud. All right, guys, we're going to start the question part. And these are not labeled. Karen?
You know what? I didn't bring my glasses.
Okay. You want me to read them out for you? All right. Let me find one for you. All right. Someone who has been in the program for 20 years told my mother that until you have 10 years, you don't know anything and you need to shut up. Is that true? Who wants to take this?
You want me to take that one?
You sure can.
All right. That's true. No.
There we go.
I know that old-timers have always said, and all I'll ever tell you tonight is what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, or what a sponsor told me. They used to say, you know, take the cotton out of your mouth and put it in, cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. But I'll tell you, I've learned as much from a newcomer as I have from an old-timer. And honestly, there are a lot of old-timers out there that not only do I not want what they have, I've got some of it and I'm trying to lose it. So, but I think the key is to talk about recovery, to talk about what you're doing and the actions you're taking, and not the toxicity that we come in here with. Everybody knows how to get drunk. Dude, we did that, did it well. So to talk more about today and not what it used to be like all the time, because, like I said, we all know how to do that. But the more time you do get, the less you know. And that's a good thing. So stay teachable. I guess that's important. So.
Is
What's her name? You gotta read it to me. Yeah, I know.
I left my glasses down there, so I'm gonna have to read it.
Okay, Dave, how do you keep from being diverted from your primary purpose?
Oh my God. Yeah. Trust me. You know, your mind is not your friend. Just not. My mind is not my friend. My mind told me, and I could have called Terry and probably thought about 10 different reasons why I could call him and tell him I don't need to come here, can't come here, something got in the way. You know what I mean? I'm here 22 hours. I flew out of Boston at 11 this morning. I'll be home tomorrow by 10. You know? This has to be my primary purpose. I know it has to. How do I say not? How do I not let myself be diverted? Believe me. That book says on chapter 7, the first paragraph, practical experience has shown that nothing will so much ensure. You want insurance policy? Ensure your immunity from drinking as intensive work with others. Intensive. Not when I feel like it. Not when it's convenient. Not when I want to. Because more often than not, I don't feel like it. It's not convenient. And I don't want to. But I've only got those two choices. And I know what I've got to do on a daily basis. Take me away from you guys just for a couple of minutes. A couple of days, rather. And I start to feel it. My spirit starts to sink again. My spirit starts to go down. Just take me away for a little while. And I start to feel it. So it's that keeps me as focused as I can be as my primary purpose. Our primary purpose, it says so in the preamble. Stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. That's our collective primary purpose. And my primary purpose in my life is to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. Because I've proven without 1 ounce of doubt and without 1 ounce of reservation that, you know, unless I'm sober, nothing in my life works. And the only way I know how to stay sober is when I'm helping someone else to do the same. Carrying the message. You gotta put this first. You just gotta put this first. When you straighten out spiritually, the book tells you, the physical and the mental will follow. And one by one by one by one, every one of those problems will disappear. And that's been my experience. I gotta put you first. That's what it is.
Karen, I believe that AA and NA are the same, abstinence from drugs / alcohol. Handle financial fear.
It comes down to one word for me and you guys, and still that way today, 9 years later. You know, I left out the part where I have yet to be reinstated. I'll be reinstated hopefully probably within the next 6 months. But not one day since I started this journey into recovery on July 21st when that man came into my life. Not one day have I gone without food. Not one day have I gone without drink. Not one day have I gone without shelter. My wallet empty and fills and empty and fills and empty and fills. I trust God. That third step says it, you guys. When I stay about his business, it says so. When we sincerely, the 100 men and women said at the top, page 63, we sincerely took such a position, that of an agent, that of an employee of God, all sorts of remarkable things followed. He gave us everything we need so long as we stay close and do his work well. I stay close to him, and I try to do his work well. I don't know what well means. All I know is this. I do this thing with the best of my ability, I do it with all my heart, and I do it every day. And when I do that, I get everything I need. Do I have the money? Am I making the money I made? I used to make hell no. We both talked about that tonight. It's not that. You know? But I've gotten everything I've needed. There are a lot of things I want along the way. But there's a huge trust that comes in it. You know? My sponsor said, trust me till you can trust God. Trust me that you can trust the problem. The problems will get solved. You know? And here's where it comes in. You can't get here from where I was. You can't do that. It's humanly impossible, guys. I didn't plan the path that got me here. You know, and I just have to continue to trust. The word's trust and the answer is trust. Trust God. Those two words are huge and they're not always easily done. My sponsor said, you want to get to know God? Get to know His kids. Focus on His kids, stay with His kids, hang with His kids, run with His kids, and you'll touch and you'll see and you'll feel God. And He'll give you everything you need. And my financial insecurity, sure. It comes and it goes. I'm human. Feet of clay. But when I stay about His business, here I am to report to you guys. I get everything I need. And it just seems to keep happening that way. And I don't see any reason why it's because my sponsor promised me. You know, if I just keep doing what I've been doing, I'm going to keep getting what I'm getting. And that's the way it's been.
This is for either of you. How should I pick my sponsor?
Is yours working?
Yeah. Yeah, I was taught that I go to a lot of meetings, go to women's meetings, and find somebody that I want what they have. And my first sponsor I picked because I really liked her car. We didn't work out that long, to tell you the truth, because she actually sent me to a workshop for the four steps. She said she wasn't real good at that. Then I realized what I really needed was a woman who could take me by the hand and walk me through the steps. That's what sponsorship is about. So somebody that can truly, who's worked all 12 steps. I also believe, for me, it's important that my sponsor has a sponsor. Because it's all about how we pass it on from one generation of Alcoholics Anonymous to another. So somebody who has a sponsor, works the steps, sponsors other women, and is real active in Alcoholics Anonymous. That woman, I want what she has. And that's who I ask.
This is for either of you as well. How long should I be sober before I start sponsoring others?
Sure.
Let's go with history. Let's go with literature. What does it tell us? When I'm sponsoring somebody, you know, it took me three weeks to go to take these steps with my sponsor. I spent 3 days face-to-face and the remainder over the phone. And like I told you, when I was 3 weeks over on that 12th step, he spun me around. He said, get out there and do it now. Your life depends upon it. And don't wait for that guy to come to you. You go get him. He told me, look to see what you can bring. Find that person. And if you look at history, Rowan Hazard found Eddie. Eddie went searching for Bill. Bill went searching for Bob. And Bill and Bob went searching for A, number 3, Bill Dodson. Bill Wilson, he had 6 months when he met Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob had 2 weeks when he met Bill Dodson. But here's the most important thing I'll say. And you guys check me out. The bottom of page 9, Bill's story. He talks about the day that Eddie Thatcher came to his house. That night near the end of that bleak November in 1934. Bill was sitting home alone this night. He was drinking gin in his bathrobe. Eddie's sponsor, a guy named Roland Hazard, Eddie had been through the steps, the equivalent of the steps. They weren't called the steps then, but they're the same actions. 2 months. September and October of 1934, he took those steps. And Eddie Thatcher was told by his sponsor, Roland, now go help someone. Who? Called Bill Wilson. He calls Bill near the end of that bleak November and says, Bill, I'm in New York. I'm sober. I want to come over and have dinner. And Bill says, hell yeah, I'll have dinner with him. And then I'll drink openly with him. I'm mindful of his welfare, he says. The doorbell rings. There he stood, fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He sits down at the table. Bill sits down at the table with Eddie and pushes the bottle of gin across the table. Bill tells us this on page 9 in his book. And Eddie pushes it back. Bill says to him, what's up? What's up with you? Eddie says, I found religion. Bill goes, aha, that's it, religion. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. This summer, they cracked about religion. Well, that's fine. My bottle will last a hell of a lot longer than his preaching. Here's my point. The last paragraph on page 9, I'm going to quote for you verbatim. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, Eddie told me how two men had appeared in court and convinced the judge to suspend his commitment. Eddie was about to get arrested 2 months before that. He talked about a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the results were self-evident. It worked. That's Bill Wilson talking about Eddie Thatcher carrying the message 2 months. That was 2 months ago. There he stood, fresh-skinned and glowing, inexplicably different. Bill didn't get sober that night. 2 weeks later, he'd check into the town's hospital, December 11, 1934, and he'd stay sober for the next 39 years until he died. And for the next 39 years, he will tell everyone Eddie Thatcher was his sponsor. Eddie carried him the message with 2 months of sobriety. Guys, he didn't even have a 60-day chip in his pocket. And he carried Bill Wilson the message. When you decide you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, you're ready to take certain steps. Once you've taken them, your life depends upon you going out there and carrying this message. If you have to go through these steps in 3 days, get out there and start. That's what the answer is. History will tell you. Bill Wilson's sponsor had 2 months. Dr. Bob, less than 2 weeks when he went to the Akron City Hospital and found AA number 3. Get out there and do it. Get out there and do it. Can't say the wrong thing.
The key is you've worked the steps.
Okay, this last one's for Dave. How do you do your amendments towards your enemies?
There's still some on my list that I've trouble with. There's two on my list that I still have trouble with. There's two big ones out there. I do them with direction of a sponsor. I do them with trust in God. And I do them knowing that they're a very, 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 very important part of what we're doing here. I need my side of the street clean as clean can be, so I can get out there. I need nothing impeding my ability to go out there and help others. My sponsor says the whole reason why I do a fourth and a fifth is so I get a proper perspective on 8 and 9. You know, so the best and the only way I know how to make my amends is, number one, with direction from my sponsor, and number two, a huge trust in God, and number three, no expectation on how they're going to turn out. Because I'm not there to be received well, because a lot of times I'm not. In my experiences, I haven't been, but I have to do it. It's part of it. Our job is in cleaning house. Those three words, trust God, clean house, help others. The cleaning house is very important. And I just do it just as simple as that. With direction from my sponsor and a huge trust in God. You know, and the fears will fall from us. And I say that openly admitting I still have two that I've been backing on. I don't think the fourth step is nearly as hard. The ninth step is the one that I had the most trouble with. And I'm determined to take care of those. I've already talked about this just recently in the last 2 weeks. I'm determined to take care of those two. I have not those two amends I still have left outstanding. I'm determined to take care of those in the next 2 weeks. I'm just not letting them go any longer. But that's just my experience. So.
All will be revealed too. I mean, what you see, you know, at 5 years will be different. At 9 years will be different. At 15 years, and the road gets a little narrower. You know, I had one where somebody from high school, you know, I told my sponsor about it, and I thought, sure, she'd give me a pass on that one, right? And it was high school, for God's sake. She said, oh, no, you got to make that one. And I did, and I was driving across country from Las Vegas to here with the bird and the cat and the car. Oh, my God, they looked like the Okies and the Arkies coming across country. And I stopped in Southern Illinois and saw a friend that I hadn't seen in years, long time, and made a very, very old amend, and it was as freeing as it was the one that I made early on. So, again, the road gets narrower, and more will be revealed, and you just keep working your program, and it gets better and better.
Thank you so much, guys. All right, if anyone that would like to join us, we have a nice way of closing with the Lord's Prayer.